this episode, JLI one-shots, including JLI 80-page giant number 1 from 1998, Justice League Unlimited number 43 from 2008, and DC Retroactive JLI the 90s from 2011. That's a lot of things to say. Hello, and welcome to the Justice League International Bwahaha Podcast, a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. Now, folks, we may have finished the original Giffen DeMatteis run of JLI, but we have still got lots to cover before we shut the doors on this podcast. My name is the Irredeemable Shag, and I'm your host, but guess what, folks? I have brought along some friends. I've got three different co-hosts today to help me look at three different JLI-related one-shots, each from the mind of Keith Giffen. First, we've got from 1998, JLA 80-page giant number 1, with a story by Giffen and McGuire featuring Booster and Beetle called Mouse Busters. Then from 2008, in Justice League Unlimited number 43, we've got a story by Giffen featuring the blue and the gold called Wannabes. And finally, from 2011, DC Retroactive JLA the 90s, with a story by Giffen, DeMatteis, and McGuire featuring the Injustice League called Apocalypse No. Now, in this episode, each one-shot will feature a different co-host. Now, first up is a returning guest to the JLI podcast. He comes all the way from our Scottish embassy. He's been a comics blogger, and he's a geek fitness enthusiast. Seriously, this guy has a crazy obsession with yoga. In fact, he's such a great yoga instructor, he'll bend over backwards for you. Folks, please help me welcome back to the show, Mr. Matt Ev. Welcome back to the embassy, Matt. Thanks for being here, man. How you doing?
I'm great. Thanks, Shag. Thank you for having me. I've decided in order to survive the experience of doing your podcast again, I'm going to draw on both my yoga powers and my experience as a JLI reader and practice an ancient Martian meditation technique. It's known as screaming.
Oh, we couldn't fit better. You know, you and I both have a certain follically challenged issue, like Martian Manhunter. Can you extend the back of your head like he does when he does that?
I can, but I choose not to.
Ah, it's a choice.
Yeah, it ruins the shape of my hat. So,
so I got to ask you, we're going to talk about JLA 80-page giant number 1. Now, do you have any experience with this from 1998, or is this your first time reading it?
Oh, I bought it when it came out, basically when I first started getting into Justice League and JLI and all that sort of thing, which was kind of in the early to mid-90s. So I was sort of catching up with JLI, and then I was all in when JLA started, and I still think that's probably the best comic of the 90s, Morrison's JLA. And so I was all in on that, and I continued through until Byrne came on the book during that sort of Doom Patrol revival, in which case I sort of, I kind of drifted away from JLA at that point, then came back for Brad Meltzer, and then came back for more recent incarnations, but only briefly. JLA in the 90s is it for me. So yes, I was there, and I was all in on this book at the time.
I had forgotten. Like, when you said Byrne, I'm thinking, what is he talking about? I had blocked that era out.
Everyone has. It was god-awful.
And I should have known when I started that question. You're a huge Morrison fan, so of course you're a read JLA. So, yeah.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
So, you know, this is from 1998, right? So, as Matt said, you know, Morrison's JLA is in full swing at this point, right? And bear in mind, as we do this, like, at this point in history, in 1998, the JLI, meaning our beloved Wahaha era, it's basically a punchline and a punching bag. I mean, the fans hated this stuff at this point. So, keep that in a sort of as a perspective in the back of your mind as we cover this story. Now, as we get into this, we do need to take a second to thank our sponsors. Folks, this episode of the JLI podcast is sponsored in part by InStockTrades.com. InStockTrades is your best online source for trades, hardcovers, and other collected editions, all for up to 42% off with free shipping on orders of $50 or more. Now, each episode we'll select a collected edition to briefly discuss from the InStockTrades library. Usually it's tied into this month's JLI issue in some way, shape, or form. I picked Hero Squared Omnibus Trade Paperback. Now, this is super fun. This comes from Boom Studios, so it has nothing to do with JLI except that it's written by Giffen and DeMatteis. Lots and lots of fun. It's about this slacker, a guy named Milo, who turns out on a parallel universe, he's not a slacker. He's like the legendary superhero of the universe named Captain Valor. And he ends up coming to this universe, so Milo and Captain Valor are together. Turns out Milo's girlfriend in the other universe is a supervillain. I mean, it's just a lot of fun cross-universe hijinks. It's very awesome. This particular omnibus collects all of it. The three-issue miniseries, the six-issue limited series, some specials, the planetary brigade, Brigade spinoff, which was super fun as well. Again, published by Boom Studios, Giffen and DeMatteis. Artist is Joe Abrams. It's full color, soft cover. It's about 200 pages. Originally went for $39.99, and it's 30% off right now, so you can get it for $27.99. And it is an absolute hoot. I love this thing, so check out Hero Squared Omnibus. Now, what about you, Matt? Did you bring anything to talk about?
I have, yes. Although somewhat reluctantly, as I can't order from Unstock Trades being in Scotland, so this is painful for me. Like, you get these discounts and I do not. But yes, going with the theme of a fun comic featuring a rodent that we're doing today, I've gone with The Unbeatable Squirrel Girl by Ryan North and Erica Henderson. So there's the Unbeatable Squirrel Girl hardcover volume 1, which collects issues 1 to 8 of Unbeatable Squirrel Girl, plus material from Marvel Superheroes, GLX Xmas Special, however you say that, issues of The Thing and Age of Heroes. And Squirrel Girl is a fantastic, fun comic, very much in the spirit of the more sort of bonkers end of JLI. So I would thoroughly recommend.
That's awesome. So it looks like it's 248 pages. It's a hardcover and normally goes for $34.99, but it's 38% off. So you can get it for $21.69. That's a heck of a steal. And I've never read Squirrel Girl stuff except when she showed up in other comics. So I've been meaning to get it. So this looks like it's a great starting point. So I may have to check this out.
You probably should. Yeah.
So, folks, for these and all your other trade paperback needs, please visit InStockTrades.com. Now, this episode is also sponsored in part with your Patreon support, because, you know, running the Fire & Water Podcast Network with so many shows requires a lot of online hosting and other services, and a while back, we realized we needed some help with the expenses. So we launched a Patreon, and you folks really stepped up to help keep the network going. So if you're enjoying the JLI Podcast, the best way to support the show is by visiting our Patreon at patreon.com/FW Podcast, and while you're there, please consider supporting the network. In a certain tiers, you get mentioned on your show of choice. Just like these folks who asked to be recognized on the JLI Podcast. Our thanks go out to Bill Beer, Christopher Lewis, David Ace Gutierrez, DC Dave, Devin Clancy, Doug Adamson, George Van Note, Gord Tolton, John Coos, Kevin Wetter, Mark Baker Wright, Martin Gray, Maxwell Traver, Michael Crouch, Mike Zumkowski, Roger Preeb, Rudy Castillo, Sean Ross, Superman Radio Revisited Podcast, Symbol Pending, Tim Price, and some goober named Matt Ev. Again, folks, visit our Patreon at patreon.com/FW Podcasts. All right. Now, remember, folks, get out on the social media and we want to hear your thoughts on this issue. You know, JLA 80 Page Giant. We want to hear your thoughts on where the JLI was in 98 as far as the fans felt or you know, the story, any bit of it. Please chime in. There's got a lot more stories we're going to be talking about in this issue. So please be part of the discussion. Especially on our website, which is fireandwaterpodcast.com/JLI. All right, now normally this is the part of the show where we chat with a guest about their experience and where they first fell in love with the JLI. But if you go all the way back to May 2019, Matt, that's the before times, by the way.
God, I'm old. Oh my God.
Matt and I talked about Justice League Europe number 2, which is Matt shared his JLI origin there, so be sure to check that out. All right, folks, I will be posting some images from all three of these stories over on our network, which is firewaterpodcast.com. Again, go to that/JLI. You'll be able to see a few of the pages there. All right, let's get into this. So this is JLA 80 Page Giant number 1, published by DC Comics, cover dated July 1998, on the shelves May 13th, 1998. Cover price is $4.95. It is, shockingly, 80 pages. Now, the cover is by Kevin McGuire and Carl Story. It is not specific JLI themed, but I figured we should mention it. I mean, it's by Kevin McGuire and Carl Story, and it's got a giant image of some green dude. Who is that guy?
That would be John Jones, or at least that's how I pronounce it, looking absolutely hench. The guy's huge. Look at the state of him.
He is huge. Hench? Is that like a Scottish? Is that like haggis? What is that? I don't know what that is.
Maybe. The guy's just buff.
Yeah.
Absolutely ripped and enormous. You have to bear in mind he's a shapeshifter, though, so this is an act of pure vanity on his part.
That is so true. Yeah, because McGuire always drew him really, you know, very small and, you know, he's tall, but, you know, kind of lanky. And here he is really rippling with the muscles. But by this point, I mean, you know, a JLA book was described, you know, already showing Martian Manhunter as a big guy at this point.
Yeah.
We also get inset images of Batman, Wonder Woman, and Red Tornado, and a whole laundry list of all the characters that appear in this 80-page giant.
Okay, so we've got that image of Wonder Woman on the side there pulling a very strange expression, mm-hmm. which looks like she's had lemon juice squirted into a paper cut.
She does look very uncomfortable, doesn't she? And this is the era where Kevin McGuire was drawing kinky hair, like almost like snakes, you'll see.
Indeed. But it does raise the question of whether an Amazon can get a paper cut, or are they invulnerable to such things?
Well, maybe it's like a Promethium sheet of paper? I was going to say Adamantium, but I had the wrong universe.
And it's also interesting you got Red Tornado there, given that Kevin Maguire is such an expert at drawing facial expressions, and Red Tornado is not exactly renowned for his expressive qualities.
That actually makes it pretty funny, I think.
He's looking weirdly human there. Yes. I think Kevin Maguire can't help but bring that into even this inert robotic face.
And this is an era where Red Tornado was just a mess, after Primal Force and going into Young Justice, Red Tornado was a complete mess. And so this was definitely a strange time for him.
Was he ever not?
Oh, but a bunch. All right, so we are going to get inside, but we are going to focus specifically on the 10-page story, Mousebusters. The script is by Keith Giffen. Now, note, there's no JMD Mateus along. Keith's flying solo on this one. Penciler is Kevin Maguire. Inker is Carl Story. Letter is Bob LePan. Colorist is Gene D'Angelo. And editors are Dan Rassler and Tony Bedard. Now, I'm going to do a quick recap of the story, and then we're going to get into discussing it. Now, remember, it's only 10 pages, so it's pretty quick in and out. The story opens recreating that classic moment from JLI number 7, where Guy Gardner's crawling around under the computer console looking for his Green Lantern ring, when he's suddenly startled by a mouse and bangs his head on the console, knocking himself out, and frankly, his personality as well. Now, discovering a mouse is loose in the Justice League computers, Blue Beetle and Booster Gold team up to take on the rodent, placing far too many traps all around the headquarters. The team debates the best way to solve the problem, but Guy Gardner objects to killing the mouse because Guy's head injury has turned him into a kind and gentle soul. Beetle finally develops a device that will trap the mouse and transport it into one of the teleport tubes. Unfortunately, Beetle didn't take into account the size ratio factor and ends up magnifying the mouse into a 7-foot-long behemoth that then chases the Blue and the Gold throughout the headquarters. And of course, Guy runs after them, begging them not to harm the mouse. All right, so this is pretty bizarre, but it's fun because it fits right into the JLI continuity. You know, big picture, though, what did you think of this one?
I mean, it's short and silly, but lots of fun. And it's drawn by Kevin Maguire, so I'm all in.
Yeah, exactly.
I enjoyed this immensely, basically.
One of the things I find amazing is, and I didn't even realize this, the internet had to tell me this, but the first three panels on the first page of the story match almost exactly the last three panels on the first page of JLI number 7. And what that means is there's three panels in JLI number 7 where Guy's crawling around under the computer console, bangs his head, and knocks himself out. Well, here, Kevin has recreated those same three panels. Now, he's done them like at a different angle. Guy's butt is shinier. I mean, you know, the art has certainly improved, but it's the same dialogue, the same sound effect, all that stuff. And then it just, rather than cutting away, which is what it did in the original story, here it keeps going. And you see the mouse and you see all the circumstance about it, which is a lot of fun.
And Guy's unconscious face here is wonderful. I mean, it's completely the same across, what, 5 panels there?
Yes.
But I'm sure we've all seen our friends crash out on the couch looking like this. It's exactly that expression.
It looks like there should be a little puddle of drool, you know, as yes. Well, right?
I like to think that's just out of frame there.
Right. And I like how the mouse actually looks and mugs for the camera. And he looks right at the reader and goes, glick, glick, which is great.
That's beautiful. Beautiful.
Now, one thing to point out, and this isn't really part of the story, but just as a reminder to people, people forget a lot that it was not the one punch that changed Guy's personality. It was being startled by a teeny tiny mouse and bumping his own head. So that's always been part of the gag that was so funny about Guy's personality change. It was, you know, his own fear of a teeny tiny mouse, which is great.
It's lovely.
Again, this story fits within the continuity of JLI issue 7. Like, you could just wedge it right in within the issue. But it's crazy to think that it came out a decade after JLI number 7. That's how long it's been. A little more than a decade, really. Let me ask you, like, at this point in history, you know, the JLI were a joke, right? You know, people treated them as a joke. People were very negative about the JLI era. Do you think this story helped to redeem some of people's feelings, like reminded them that it was funny? Or do you think it just, reinforced the fact that the JLI was silly?
I honestly don't know, because for me, the JLI was still kind of contemporary because I came to it after it had started. It was a few years in by the time I started reading it.
Mm.
So it kind of overlapped with my starting to read JLA, and then I wasn't aware that it had this terrible reputation in the 90s. I wasn't on message boards or anything like that. So I was just reading it in my own little bubble. So to me, it makes perfect sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I was kind of reading the two, and I was still collecting back issues of JLI while JLA was coming out, and I was filling in those gaps at that time. So to me, it's all part of the same thing. It's part of the same universe and the same continuity, and didn't feel like it was removed from it.
Gotcha.
So I just like to be in my own little happy world when it comes to comics.
Right.
Pay too much attention to what the narrative is. You know.
Well, I can't even answer my own question because I don't remember either whether if this like helped to elevate the JLI and helped to maybe rehabilitate it or not. I don't recall. Well, I'll ask you a question a different way then. Since you're saying it's all kind of a piece, you know, Jam DeMatteis isn't here. You know, the magic formula is missing one of the three pillars. You know, do you feel like this story suffered for not having DeMatteis?
No, I don't, because I think this is such a short, silly, frivolous little story that I don't think there's time to feel the absence of him. You know what I mean? I think he maybe contributed some of the heavier stuff in JLI. So I get the impression that Giffen brought a bit more of the silliness and Jam DeMatteis brought more of the drama. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, no, I think that is fair to say. I think also brought a lot of sharp humorous dialogue, though. And so as I read this, I felt like this was great. You know, it was a lot of fun. I do think if DeMatteis had been involved, some of the dialogue would have been a little, because I've just read a lot of Giffen DeMatteis stuff together recently. I read a bunch. And so like, I felt like the dialogue would have been a tiny bit sharper. You know, some of the jokes would have just hit a little bit more, but it's still great. I mean, again, if I hadn't been reading a ton of this stuff recently, I wouldn't even, and I don't even know if I'm noticing or I'm just filling in a blank in my head. I don't know. It sounds like I'm complaining, but I'm not really at all. So I should probably stop this train because I'm not going anywhere with it. So it's a lot of fun, folks. It felt really, really great. Now, if we want to put on our nerd pocket protectors and get all fussy about things, we could point out, so this takes place, again, within JLI number 7. And in here, Beetle and Booster are best of friends. I mean, he even calls Booster at one point, like, old friend or something like that. But truly, the blue and the gold bromance doesn't actually start till JLI number 8, the next issue.
Mm-hmm. One with the Booster pursuing Catherine.
Exactly right. Yes. I knew I could rely on you to bring her up. So this is before they actually become friends. So it's a little bit out of sync there, but come on, it's 10 years later. Who cares? It works great.
However, I think the seeds for their friendship were planted back in issue 4.
Oh?
Because it's Beetle and Booster who take down Ace from the Royal Flush Gang as a sort of impromptu team-up.
Good point.
I think that's where it begins, and this can be seen as like the bridge between JLI 4 and issue 8.
Oh, that's perfectly fair, because there's, even though I was saying the romance is right, there's nothing that directly contradicts what comes later. So it all works. Well done. You get your no prize, sir.
Yay. I look forward to my Christmas bonus.
Exactly right. The Wharf Rat reoccurring joke is great. I love that. What a strange thing to get hung up on, but it's pretty funny. And they do that kind of David Letterman style where the joke repeats. It's funny at first. Then it's kind of like, why is this still here? And then it keeps coming back to the point where it becomes funny again. It works well.
I guess it pays off when the mouse becomes much larger than an actual wharf rat by the end.
It's perfect. Love that. Now, there's some great artistic stuff in here I love. Like page 25 of the story, McGuire does something that he always did, which is fantastic, which is where he shows a static location and repeats that same image over and over. In this case, it's the exterior shot of the JLA, Secret Sanctuary Cave. Mm-hmm. And you get all the dialogue and the sound effects surrounding it, so you have to interpret what's happening yourself. For example, in this one, Martian Manhunter is reading Blue Beetle, basically the Riot Act, in a nice way, because he's gone crazy with mousetraps. In fact, I'm not sure, because, it all happens off-panel. I think, does Martian Manhunter snap a mousetrap on Blue Beetle's nose? Is that what happens there?
He does, yes, because you see the snap sound effect, and then in the next page, Beetle's got a plaster over his nose there. So yes, definitely what happened, because it's on John's finger, and he's looking very, you don't actually see his face, but he's clearly not happy about the situation.
Right.
Look at Beetle's yawning face on his first panel on that page as well.
Right. The yawn is perfect, and then he's looking at the mousetrap going like, "Ee!" I mean, again, you said it earlier, McGuire is the master of facial expressions, and he's just going to town on this thing here.
Oh, absolutely. They're amazing in this short story. Some of the best he's ever done, I'd say.
It's really glorious, and you can really see how much he'd grown from when he left the book, right around, 89 or whenever it was, to 98, 10 years later. I mean, the guy just, his artistic style exploded unbelievably. And they do the repeating thing again on the last page, where you get Martian Manhunter's reading a book in the foreground. Mm-hmm. And now in this case, rather than not seeing the action, you're seeing the action, but only a teeny tiny piece of it. Like through the door frame behind him, you see like Beetle and Booster running from the rat. You see Guy Gardner. I mean, it's a 9-panel grid, which is pretty great because there's a few of those in here, of course, celebrating the old JLI style. But what do you think, this last page, does it put the button on it? Is the joke work for you?
Oh, it's delightful. And it's John in the foreground being completely just over everything, over this whole thing. And I think he's kind of the star throughout this story, even though he's not the main character, just because he's drifting through this nonsense like he's just so tired of this. As I say, we're still only at issue 7 or 8 here, so, you know.
Right. But, you know, in retrospect, though, it is the perfect way to celebrate him. He's even eating Oreos in one scene. Yeah. So I don't know that I agree that Martian Manhunter is the star of it, but I know you're a big fan of the character, so I'll let you know.
I am. And I would note as well that on this last page, he's not wearing his cape here or his medallions, which he's very rarely seen without those.
Oh, interesting.
And considering that they're arguably part of his body, is this just what he does to wind down in the evening?
It's Casual Friday, he's getting ready for the bed, you know, or something like that.
But those panels where you got Beetle, you got Booster, you got the mouse, and then you've got Guy running past are just delightful. Ugh. Especially the mouse there.
Yeah,
this enormous mouse creeping into the door frames, incredible. Yeah.
As they look back, you know, 10 years later, so, and this, they may have thought this was the last chance they were ever going to get to revisit the characters. I mean, who knows? You know, the story was gone. Why would they get the chance to revisit characters? That doesn't really happen in comics back then. So maybe they thought this would be their one chance, not knowing what was to come. And I do love that they hit some of these tropes, and we'll see some of these tropes again. In like, for example, the repeating static images, we're going to see that in DC Retroactive in just a little bit here. Mm-hmm. There's a great bit here where if you really look at it, you know, and pay attention, Beetle is the one responsible for all the crazy antics in this. You know, Booster gets the bad rap, but Beetle's the one leading all of the ridiculousness, and we'll see that in the JL just like a limited issue we're going to cover, and that was a recurring theme where it really was always Beetle's fault.
Yeah. Wasn't that the situation with Kui?
Absolutely was. Pretty much, if you go back, almost every single insane plan they had, it was Beetle, not Booster. And poor Booster gets dragged into it. And again, Booster's the one ends up with a reputation. It's insane.
I think that's fair enough, though.
Yeah.
You've got to have a fall guy.
Yeah. And he does it so well. I mean, heck, they built that whole comic around him being, you know, the hero that no one knew was a hero or whatever it was. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You get Black Canary, which is great because we only saw her in, you know, a handful of JLI issues. So it's wonderful to see her here.
In her best costume, too.
Oh, you just made my day. That is absolutely true. I adore that costume.
Everyone knows it.
No. we're some of the few people that agree the Jazzercise costume is the best, but whatever. There is a great joke in here where Guy comes in, and you know, he's got this crazy, you know, silly, new, lovable attitude. And she's looking at – there's a great panel where they're just shocked at how saccharine Guy is. It's just a silent panel. And then she says, I think the new Guy is going to get real annoying real fast, which is a great meta joke because, you know, Giffen knows that the fan base couldn't stand Guy after a while. Like the silly, mm-hmm. you know, the silly guy really got on everyone's nerves very quickly. So that has absolutely got to be a meta joke that he put in there, which is fine. It works for me.
And again, the face when she says that is incredible. Those two panels are just wonderful. She's just so disgusted. So I was also going to note that if you note on the previous page, when they're all Beetle, Booster, and Canary are in the kitchen, have you noticed their mugs? They've all got their own logos on the mugs.
I noticed the Black Canary one. I did not notice Beetle and Booster. That's really cool. Yeah. Well, that was very nice of Max to shell out the money for that.
Exactly. Well, he's a rich guy. He can afford a mug or two. So.
Or I like to think maybe they had a craft night, you know, at the Secret Sanctuary, and everyone made their own mug.
One of those pottery painting sessions, you know?
Right. Well, maybe Guy was using everyone's mugs, and they got pissed off, and they're like, we got to knock this up. Guy quit using Martian Manhunter's mug, and so they all – anyway. there's a lot of really nice stuff in here. Like, Maguire went to a lot of effort to put a lot of, like, handwork in here. This is one thing you always hear Perez talk about is when you're drawing characters, give them something to do that's real. You know, in here, you've got Black Canary. She's like picking up a tea bag and like dipping it in her cup. You know, Beetle for a long time is doing a Rubik's Cube. You know, Booster's taking off his gloves because they've got mouse poop all over them. So there's a lot of handwork in these issues, which again, is just to make it a little more real. Same thing with putting it in the kitchen. You know, it really reinforces the whole workplace comedy thing.
Absolutely. I was waiting for the Rubik's Cube thing to pay off, but it doesn't. But
I thought so too.
Yeah, I was thinking, am I missing a little background gag here? But no, it's just doing Rubik's Cube. It's what people do.
I kept waiting to find it solved. Like, yes, some, yeah. I thought that was going to be part of it. But yeah,
Genius right. Ted will solve it in 5 panels or something.
Right. Yeah. He also does something interesting that this may have been the first time Maguire did this, at least with JLI, is, you know, you can always see Beetle and Booster's eyes through their goggles, through the lenses, right? But here, they do it as a color hold. So their mm-hmm. eyes are actually done in red, or a surprint, you could call it even. Whereas normally, you know, Maguire would draw their eyes in black, so you just saw through it. So I like here that he's using the yellow lenses to make their eyes look a different color. It just makes a really nice effect, and that means Maguire had to go to that extra step to draw their eyes probably on vellum or something to make that effect. So he was really going all out here.
Yeah, it's really lovely effect. It gives them a sort of a 3D appearance on the page.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, I'm going to guess that Giffen did not do the breakdowns because other than a few 9-panel grids, the layout is very different from any JLI story. So I think by this point, Maguire had, you know, evolved so much as an artist that Giffen didn't feel the need to do that to Maguire. And I think it is really, really nice the way it's laid out. The storytelling is fantastic. There's nothing crazy or wild about the layouts, but it is extremely effective to the point where you don't even notice it. You know, it just reads so clean and so easy.
Yeah, no, it just really flows beautifully. It's really elegantly put together. Yeah, nothing experimental or adventurous about it, but yeah, it's just classic comic storytelling here.
Yeah, he was such an expert at this point, and he only gets better. I mean, you're going to see this, later on when we cover the DC retroactive issue. Wow, I mean, just Maguire is off the charts insanely talented.
There is one flub in the artwork here. Well, maybe not a flub. Maybe it's a deliberate choice. But on page 26, why does Dinah have red hair?
Okay, so I did notice that. And that's in the coloring.
Yeah, maybe it's just too much yellow at the foreground if she's next to Booster, but it does look like an error.
Oh, it's absolutely red. I mean, it's not only, you know, the orange color of red. Like, when people have red hair in real life, it's more orangey. But they've got red highlights in there. I mean, the colorist clearly thought this was a different character. I don't know what caused that to happen. But yeah, no, that's a good point to point out.
Very strange moment. But can we briefly discuss the actual mechanics of trapping this mouse?
No. Sure, of course.
The way Ted decides to solve the mouse issue is very Blue Beetle in that it's needlessly complicated.
Right.
He traps the mouse in a tube and then transports it to another tube. Just leave it in the first tube, Ted. This is completely unnecessary. But then there wouldn't be much of a story if he'd done that, so.
Right, but yeah, no, it is. It's the idea of build a better mousetrap, right? You know?
Yeah, and it also has echoes of the, is it JLI 22, which has a transporter mishap in which the miniaturized Kuns end up in the embassy.
Oh, yeah.
Size and teleporter tubes are always a bit of a problem for the JLI, it seems.
That's a good point. I hadn't thought about that. Yeah, the size ratio is in this, so that makes this a good callback, too. But yeah, it's like a Rube Goldberg machine kind of thing. Like he makes it overly complicated, which is very much, like you said, a great Blue Beetle gag. And it does make the perfect button, though, when it becomes, you know, essentially a giant wharf rat, which is so funny. I love it, and I don't think I even noticed this earlier, but on page 28, when he's looking at this little tiny device, you can actually see a little tiny cube of cheese inside.
Yeah, I just noticed that. Fantastic.
And I love the checkerboard floor. You know, Maguire always had checkerboard floors and everything. Mm-hmm. I love that effect. It looks great. It's like the doilies almost. It's worth celebrating.
And I love it when there's a sound effect and a character spells out the sound effect in their speech as well. So on the top of page 29, where the sound effect is vroom, and Beetle says, come on, don't you hear the vroom? This responds, vroom.
Very nice. I like that silhouette drawing of them running, too.
Yeah, nice, nice. Yeah, and after that, Bootle?
I call him Bootle all the time.
Bootle's a place in Liverpool, so.
Oh, jeez, okay. Yeah.
Beetle says, let's port the little sucker over to Max's place. It's not a good idea. What with the still on probation for the water balloon incident? The mind boggles what Beetle would do with a water balloon.
Well, I love that there's just little throwaways in there. Mm-hmm. You know, like there's been other problems that we don't even know about. Like, you know, expand the universe. There's stories between the story. Like Doctor Who does this all the time. They'll just throw out some random reference to a story that never happened, and it just sparks your imagination to go, oh my gosh, there's all these adventures I hadn't even thought about yet.
The stuff in the gaps is interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. I love it. Well, overall, super fun story, you know, 10 pages in and out. I mean, it's almost a one beat joke, really, across 10 pages, but who cares? It's fun. At this point, it had been, you know, 10 years since JLI started. It'd probably been, what, 6 years since the JLI was over. So this was a nice reunion kind of thing for people that love the JLI. And hopefully it helped remind some of the folks that were all persnickety about the Bwahaha era that, you know what, it is pretty darn funny for a reason. So I think I know the answer to this question. But did you enjoy the story, sir?
I did, immensely, yes. It's short, it's funny, it's silly, it's beautifully drawn. Yes, what's not to like?
Awesome. Well, now, Matt, this is the tough part. This is where we have to nominate the
Bwahaha Award.
We're going to both going to nominate the funniest moment in the story that we think it is, and both myself and Matt will pick one moment, and only one will be awarded the coveted Bwahaha Award. So, Matt, what's your pick for this story?
Well, although I'm a massive fan of JLI, I must admit I very rarely laugh out loud at a comic book. Mm-hmm. I can be amused by things, but I'll very rarely actually do the Bwahaha I'm supposed to do. There was one moment in this story that did make me do that, and so I have to give it to that. And it's that two-panel sequence with Beetle, Booster, and Black Canary when they're responding to Guy going out for coffee. And especially the pause and specifically the look on Dinah's face. Just, oh, that really got to me for some reason. The look of shock and disgust is just one of Maguire's most beautifully drawn facial expressions I've ever seen him do. So I'm giving it to that.
It's absolutely a great moment. It really is. You know, and the lines there are great where she says, I think the new guy's going to get annoying really fast.
Yeah.
And then Beetle with a raised fist. He's like, then we're agreed. The mouse must pay.
We just noticed the fist there. Oh,
people. It's hysterical. Those are amazing panels. I picked something different, but I may very quickly roll over to yours. I just picked the last page. You know, the static 9-panel grid shot of Martian Manhunter reading a book and all this chaos going on behind him. You know, Beetle running by, Booster going by, the rat going by, or the mouse, or Wharf Rat, whatever, Guy going by. It just, the last panel has Martian Manhunter, you know, putting his fingers to the crux of his nose, like, oh, I can't believe I'm part of this nonsense. And that page genuinely made me laugh. But the two panels you have are also hysterically funny. So, you know, I'll throw the decision to you, sir. Should we go with the two panels you picked or your beloved Alien Atlas, you know, giving the button at the end? What do you think?
How would you feel about calling it a draw?
That sounds fine to me. You know what? That they're both equally hilarious. So congratulations to Black Canary and Martian Manhunter and everyone else in those panels. You are the tie winners of the Bwahaha Award. Please wear it with pride. It is as tangible as our laughter. Now, Matt, I need to ask a favor. With all of your yoga training, you are probably the only one qualified and flexible enough to climb under the JLI computer bank and catch this mouse. Would you mind capturing it for us? And regardless what the rumors might say, I don't think it's a wharf rat.
I'll see what I can do, and I'll try not to bang my head.
Perfect. That would be very strange to see what kind of Matt we would get out of that. I don't even want to know. Now, don't worry, Matt. We will bring you back at the end of the show. After this podcast promo break, I'm going to head over to the DC Animated Universe to discuss JLU number 43.
According to the latest report from falsifiedstats.com, there are currently 12 million active comic book podcasts clogging up the internet superhighway, and 2.3 million new comic book podcasts are being created every single day. If you're looking for something a little different, then let me tell you about Mike's Comic Shop Roadshow. Mike travels the globe and visits comic shops along the way, talking to the owners, or really just whomever happens to be minding the store that day. And it's through these conversations that you'll meet some wonderful people and learn how comic shops are run in places like Murfreesboro, Illinois, and Liverpool, New South Wales, Australia. So check out Mike's Comic Shop Roadshow, a truly unique comic book podcast among billions of the same old, same old. Find it now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Mike, and I approve this message.
And I'm here with our second co-host for this episode, and it is another returning guest. Now, in the past, he has helped me tackle cosmic topics, such as evil alien starfish. And over on my Once Upon a Geek show, he's helped me ponder the multiverse of possibilities when you ask the question, what if? And if he'd been here for the JLI story we just covered, he certainly would have taken care of that mouse problem. Folks, please help me welcome back to the show, JT the Exterminator. Welcome to the Watchtower, JT. Thanks for being here, man. How you doing?
Hey, thanks for having me, even though it's not for the Exterminator story.
that might have been a little bit of an oversight on my part. So for you folks at home, we're covering Justice League Unlimited number 43, which JT brought to my knowledge. I didn't even know this comic existed. It was written by Keith Giffen. So he brought it to my he brought it to me. He told me about it. I was like, oh, this is great. And I said, let's have you on the show. Then I tell him what we're doing. He's like, seriously? The mouse and the exterminator? And you put me on. And so, I'm sorry about that.
That is all right, because as much as I love killing rats, I equally love the DC animated universe. So I'm good. This is perfectly fine for me. And knowing that you never even knew about this comic, that makes this all good.
Well, you actually led me down to several. Like you were going through a binge reading a bunch of these Justice League Adventures, yeah. Justice League Unlimited. And like every time you found a good one, you'd like send me the thing and I'd go read it. And I was like, oh, this is great. So I never took the time to appreciate I watched the cartoon, obviously, but I never took the time to appreciate the tie-in comic. And it's a lot of fun.
Well, and you know, the tie-in comics are, of course, loosey-goosey with some continuity. You know, the creative teams on those weren't privy to what Bruce Timm and company were doing with the shows, but there's still a lot of good stuff there, and there's a lot of headcanon stuff, too, that you could throw it all out, baby with the bathwater type of thing, or you could pick and choose. And today's issue that we're reading here, I think, can actually fit in with the DCAU just fine.
Well, I'll tell you, since you talked about the loosey-goosey part, I'll tell you one of the behind-the-scenes things. So, folks, again, this is Justice League Unlimited number 43, and it is written by Keith Giffen, and it features Booster Gold and Blue Beetle. Now, the interesting thing was this comic, while it was published in 2008, it actually was written and drawn 3.5 years before it was published. It's kind of a crazy story. It's a long story. It's over there on Christopher Jones's blog, but he basically explains that they had this great idea for this issue, and it's phenomenal, but suddenly, as they were doing it during the Justice League era, they then said, oh, wait, we're developing an episode with Booster Gold. We want you to hold off on the comic. So the comic got held because they were going to develop this Booster Gold episode, which was, of course, that awesome episode we all love called The Greatest Story Never Told.
Well, in the Justice League Adventures, the tie-in comic prior to Justice League Unlimited tie-in comic, that came to an end. It was like the next month Justice League Unlimited number one came out to kind of have that synergy with the show. And as the Justice League Unlimited run happened of the comic, once you started to get into these issue 40s, I think they did a few of those like that took place during the original Justice League, almost as if they were inventory stories. So this kind of makes sense.
That's exactly what they were. They were inventory stories. And part of the holdup between the fact that this had been held off earlier, also it was 22 pages, whereas at this point, Justice League Unlimited had been cut down to 20 pages. So suddenly they had to not only deal with the booster issue, they had to figure out how to cut 2 pages. So anyway, they ended up just doing it at the end. It's crazy. So.
Got it.
Well, before we get into the issue, I just do want to point out, folks, normally, you know, we have a chat with our guest where we talk about where JT first came to fall in love with the Justice League, but you can go back to our episode from September 2022, where JT and I talked about Justice League Europe number 26, and he told us his origin with the JLI, and if I remember right, I think you were taken over by an alien starfish in that episode as well.
Yeah, we're good friends now.
Stay in touch.
Yeah, it's kind of like Superman in the Fortress of Solitude in the DCAU. You know, he's just hanging out in my Arctic zoo, and I throw him some fish scraps now and then.
Oh my gosh. Use the lime if he misbehaves, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, folks, we're going to be talking about Justice League Unlimited number 43, published by DC Comics, cover dated May 2008, on the shelves March 5th, 2008. Cover price was $2.25. Cover is by Christopher Jones. You want to tell us about the cover?
Yeah, a very colorful cover, which I like. Basically, you got Blue Beetle, Booster Gold. They're in a very Peanuts-esque layout.
Oh,
where
yeah.
They're kind of at the table with their heads are in their hands, their elbows are up on the table there. They're simultaneously daydreaming of being members of the Justice League. And not really just members of the League, but it's like their mere presence is causing the Justice League heroes to gush with happiness. So it's definitely very, very Beetle and Booster, you know, attitude right there. Like you you said, drawn by Christopher Jones, who I got to say, both in the cover and he does the interior art, perfectly captures that Justice League Unlimited style, that Bruce Timm style. It's very an animated look, clean line work and color and everything else like that. Perfect fit.
Oh, he's fantastic. He also did a whole bunch of Young Justice stuff, and he's also a super nice guy. He's always at the Doctor Who convention I go to every year, and so I've had a chance to chat with him off and on over the years. Super, super nice guy. So the things I love about the cover, too, is like they're daydreaming, right? And it says A League of Their Own, which is hilarious. And like Beetle is dreaming of all the characters, you know, like celebrating him. Like, you know, Batman's shaking his hand and smiling. Flash has got his hand on his shoulder. You know, even Superman's like looking over going like, oh, geez, it's Blue Beetle. Yeah. Whereas Booster Gold is talking to Hawkgirl and Wonder Woman, and Wonder Woman's body language completely screams, you know, teenage girl with a crush. I mean, is what Wonder Woman's body language is.
And it's nice to see that Geena Davis is there representing the Peaches. That was a League of Their Own movie reference for you.
Oh, wow. Okay. I was not getting that, but now I totally understand where you're going for.
Yeah.
I love that movie.
She's not there. Maybe it's just my copy because I drew her in. Never mind.
That could be it. That could be. Mine has Rosie O'Donnell on the cover. I don't know what that's about. So, but I also like on the bottom where they're daydreaming, like Beetle looks so happy. And Booster just, I read, maybe he's just like swooning because of them, but I read it as like he's just disbelieving that they'll ever achieve this kind of status. Like they can't believe it'll ever happen. I don't know.
It could go either way, I think, with that.
Yeah. Either way, it's absolutely fantastic. Does great. It sells the comic without a doubt. Inside is written by Keith Giffen. Now, no DeMatteis this time. He's on his own. So it's Keith Giffen, penciled by Christopher Jones. Inker is Dan Davis. Letter is Randy Gentile. Colors is Heroic Age. Editors is Rachel Gluckstern and Steve Wacker. I'm going to do a quick recap here for you of the story. So bear in mind, again, even though this is a Justice League Unlimited issue, that story, as I mentioned earlier, takes place during the original cartoon run, you know, Justice League. Or Justice League Adventures for the comic book version. So the team is just the original seven members. So here we go. The story opens and we're introduced to Booster Gold and Blue Beetle, brand new to their superhero careers. They've got their costumes, they got their gadgets, but they have no experience fighting crime. And Beetle's idea is for them to stop supervillains, impress the Justice League, and petition for league membership. Now, their true goal is to cash in on merchandising opportunities and endorsement deals and TV rights. They basically want to get rich quick, right? So Beetle and Booster, they follow a tip and find a supervillain group called the Demolition Team destroying an unfinished skyscraper that's under construction. While Beetle and Booster plan to do that, the Justice League arrive to stop the Demolition Team. Well, Beetle and Booster, they're like, this is their collar, right? So they jump in to help, but end up causing problems for the League. Beetle accidentally blinds Jon Stewart, while Booster mistakenly traps Wonder Woman inside his force field. Now, due to Booster and Beetle's interference, the Demolition Team escapes, and the League are furious with the Blue and the Gold. You know, Jon Stewart delivers this super stern lecture, and while Wonder Woman is ready to pummel the duo. Luckily, Beetle tagged one of the Demolition Team with a tracking device, which leads our heroes to the villain's hideout. The League makes quick work of the Demolition Team, showing Booster and Beetle that being heroes is more than just a costume. It takes training and dedication. And Batman lectures the Blue and the Gold about being heroes for the right reasons, not for fame and glory. Unfortunately, the lecture falls on deaf ears. The final page shows a flyer on a corkboard promoting a superhero business called 1-800-SUPERDUDES. All right, so what'd you think of this one, buddy?
I loved it. I mean, it definitely captures, of course, the Blue and Gold team that, you know, we all love. The fact that you have, well, this features Batman, Wonder Woman, and Green Lantern only, even though the cover has the whole team. Have those three specific characters written, I mean, exactly like the show. And I don't know about you, but when I read these, I do hear all of those voice actors. You know, Phil LaMarr, Jon Stewart, you know, Susan Eisenberg, Kevin Conroy, you can just hear it. And coupled with this artwork, it feels like you're watching an episode, honestly.
It really does. And Phil LaMarr especially was just coming through with it when Jon Stewart was pissed off. And it's just like, yes. I could hear his voice.
Yeah.
And I got to say credit to Christopher Jones here, because, you know, Beetle and Booster, this, again, was drawn 3 years before it was published. So this was drawn before Justice League Unlimited. So this was the first time Booster and Beetle were designed for the DC animated universe, and they look great. And this version of Booster is pretty much spot on. Well, maybe not the goggles, but almost spot on for what ended up on TV. I mean, it's very, very close. So great job designing it for this look, and they look fantastic.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And they've always had a good design to begin with that almost lends itself to animation. It is a shame. I will mention it now. It's a shame. You know, we never saw Ted in the series itself on TV. And I guess there was a rights issue with that because the goal was to put Ted on the team. From what I read, there was a Bruce Timm interview or it might have been one of the other showrunners, but that was the goal. They couldn't do it. But years later, just recently, there was a miniseries called Justice League Infinity. Did you hear about that?
Written by DeMatteis, wasn't it?
Yes, it was written by DeMatteis, mm-hmm. and it officially is considered canon to the DCAU. It picks up after the events of Justice League Unlimited, and Blue Beetle is on the team.
Oh, that's great! Okay.
Yes, so he's a very minor character. You know, he's in a couple panels, but he's there hanging with Ralph and Wally and everybody, and like I said, this could very well be his introduction to the DCAU, and then we see him that he is on the team. It's just we never saw him animated, you know, on TV. That's all.
That's really cool. As far as his character traits, I just want to point, it's funny, like reading this as you go through it, and it's just this way in Justice League Unlimited, I mean, International as well. Blue Beetle's the one that has all the harebrained schemes. He is, like in the Justice League International issues, he's always the one getting Booster in trouble. He is always the one with the crazy ideas, and it's the same thing here. Booster is almost the voice of reason, and Beetle's the one who's nuts. And it's just funny because, you know, ultimately, Booster has the worst reputation. He's the one that everyone, you know, makes fun of, but Beetle's the troublemaker.
Yeah, that is very true. Hey, what's it like for you to have a podcast once again talking about the Demolition Team? Because other than Who's Who, did you ever talk about these guys in any other episode?
No. Well, you know, Keith and I might have talked about them when we covered some Green Lantern comics. I can't remember. And okay, there was a Justice League International episode where we talked about Guy Gardner's history with Green Lantern Corps. But the Demolition Team are, like, I love them because I love the idea of a themed team, like, where everyone's kind of, but they're the dumbest themed team. I mean, they're just so idiotic. It's such a dumb idea. But I love it because of it.
They are the Kmart Wrecking Crew is what I've always called them.
Yes, they are. The Dollar Store Wrecking Crew.
Yeah, exactly. But it does fit here pretty well. And, you know, again, you know, Beetle and Booster taking down the Demolition Team. Personally, I mean, Batman could have probably taken care of this entire thing. What does Green Lantern and Wonder Woman even have to show up for? You know, but it works here pretty well because you need a team of baddies that they can, you know, beat up on. I will say, so obviously we've talked about how beautifully drawn this is. There are some panels in here, a few, that just you get that feel of animation, that feel of movement. Mm-hmm. Now, I have the physical copy, so I don't have page numbers. I don't know how it is with the digital. Okay. But there's a shot where Batman gets flung off of the building that's in construction.
Oh, and, so good.
Yeah, he grapples onto it, and we're looking up, watching him like swoop down and then swoop back into the building. I mean, holy cow, it's just such a good shot, a good angle to draw that at.
Before you move on, I got to comment on that. First of all, he has attached his batarang to like the head of one of the Demolition Team, and that guy's head is the anchor for the batarang.
That's a good point. Yeah,
as he's swinging down, it's like you see three little acrobatic shots of Batman moving, and then just his cape as he disappears into the innards of the building. It reminds me a little bit of like a Paris Cullens or Ditko kind of thing, where you see the acrobat and you see them multiple times on the same page. Mm-hmm. It's just, you're right, and it looks great. The angle is what makes it work. The looking up at a tall skyscraper with the moon in the sky, it's really awesome.
And that's such an interesting choice for the moon, too. You know, you expect to just, a lot of times in comics, it seems like it's always a full moon all the time. And this is such, it's not even a normal crescent. It's like a real sliver of a crescent moon. It works so well. You usually don't see that. I know this is real weird, but to even bring up, but you don't really see that phase of the moon in comics. There's a shot in here where Blue Beetle jumps in. He's trying to help, and clearly he fumbles the ball here, but he has the BB gun out, which I think we've all kind of wished we saw more of in the regular Justice League international title. It's great to see it, and it accidentally goes off and blinds Green Lantern as he's going in. Really, really cool just to see it, because Blue Beetle needs to have his BB gun next to him.
Well, and we rarely see him in action in Justice League, right? I mean,
that's true.
Almost never. So seeing him in action is great. And then the fact that he got to use his weapon is great. There's a panel with Blue Beetle I want to mention. It's on Oh, gosh, you're right. There's no page numbers here. 1, 2, 3. It's the third page. And, like, they're, Beetle and Booster are watching the Wrecking Crew from a distance, and Beetle is ready to go. He is ready for action. And it's a six-panel grid. They're arguing in the top and the bottom. When you see Beetle in the fourth panel, he is just – he's, like, he's got this dramatic pose. It's like, almost like a Batman dramatic pose. He's ready to go. And Booster, like, distracts him. And he's like, what? And then you see him totally exasperated. I see that in animation, as you were saying. Like, I can see the body making those moves. And it's just so well done by Christopher Jones, and it's such great body language, and it's just fun.
Very true. And again, no page numbers, but after Beetle and Booster drop the ball and they got away, and so they're kind of getting chastised by the league members here, there is also this panel where he draws this group shot, but again, it's like a worm's eye view looking up, and I don't know. It's when you're drawing in this animated style, you have to really be exact and perfect with your line work because you can't hide it with details.
Mm-hmm.
And to pull off that kind of just figure work, and again, it's simplistic looking drawing, but it's just so good. It looks so cool just seeing the heroes again from that angle. It's an interesting choice, and it works so well there.
Yeah, and I got to say too, these angle choices, as far as I know, are Christopher Jones's choices. I reached out to him on Twitter just recently and asked him about this issue and asked whether Giffen did the breakdowns, because you know most of the Justice League stuff he did breakdowns. He said he's pretty sure, and that's been a lot of years, but he said he's pretty sure that Giffen wrote full script for this. So those poses would have been his choice. So great job, Christopher Jones.
Mm-hmm. A couple things I did want to mention. Right on page one, there's a couple of Easter eggs.
I'm sure you probably saw
some of this. Right in that first panel, the establishing shot, you see a fence outside of this construction site. And, well, what is it that you saw in here?
Well, I see two. Most obvious one being future site of Star Towers, luxury condominiums, and then it says M period Lord Enterprises. So you get your Maxwell Lord reference in there, which is awesome.
Which is cool. And he was in a Justice League Unlimited episode. With the Ultimen, which were kind of like knockoff versions of the Super Friends Hanna-Barbera characters.
Oh, right. That was all the ethnic characters. Yeah. Okay. Yep. I remember that.
And that was all tied into the Cadmus arc of Justice League Unlimited. So we did, Maxwell Lord is already established in the DCAU here for later on when we actually see him.
Yep. And then the other one I noticed was there's a poster for, it's labeled as Chris, K-R-I-S, then a space, is, like Chris is, like a person is, but it's really just, it's a full, cool way to say Crisis, and that's the Crisis on Infinite Earths kind of imagery from the issue one.
Yeah, I thought that was really cool. A couple things in terms of, and again, I know you told me I'm supposed to fill, what, an hour and a half with notes on this? Is that what you told me?
No, it's supposed to be a 20-minute segment, and we're already there, so way to go.
real quick, and again, this is just because of my love of, Justice League cartoon and everything. What is interesting thematically with this issue, if you are only a fan, say, of the cartoon series, is this version of Batman, he kind of argues on their behalfs, where he's telling Wonder Woman, hey, calm down. You know, we all had to start somewhere, almost as if he sees something in these two, I guess you could say, younger heroes or at least inexperienced heroes. Blue Beetle is the one that puts the tracker on the demolition team, which is a very Batman thing to do. You know, throughout BTAS, he always was throwing his little Batman tracer on people all the time. So that was a cool little thing. And maybe he realized that and like, oh, okay, maybe these guys have something. But, you know, that version of Batman at this point in time, you know, he's still working with the Tim Drake Robin, technically. And he also, we're talking about the Kevin Conroy Batman, he also had team ups with Static from Static Shock. So he's kind of already a, not really a mentor role, but maybe a little bit. And they kind of utilized him in the DCAU that way, where, you know, him being a little lenient on these guys to a certain degree, I mean, he obviously still yells at them, is kind of cool to see. And then Wonder Woman being so upset with them, she was a rookie at the beginning of Justice League, the cartoon, in that Secret Origins three-parter.
I remember.
That was when she came to, you know, the regular, you know, came off of Themyscira and everything. So she was also learning while being a part of the team. So I don't know. I don't think she should be that upset, quite honestly.
I think it's more has to do with them saying things like they were joining the Justice League to pick up chicks. I think maybe a little more why she doesn't have a lot of patience with them.
That makes a lot of sense. And my final note here was, you know, Blue Beetle is all about, oh, we're going to have the merchandising, we're going to cash in. In the season 2 two-parter of Eclipsed that introduced the DCAU Eclipso, Flash put his likeness on Lightspeed energy bars. And that was a point of contention where John Stewart, Green Lantern, was yelling at Flash. It's like, we don't do that. We don't put our names on stuff. So that was also kind of an interesting little nod to actual official continuity.
Well, given that this was written 3.5 years prior, it may have been before that episode was even done with The Flash.
That's possible. That is possible.
Yeah, interesting. There's a couple other things in here that I felt like were unknown callbacks to the future, if that makes any sense. Because, again, done before the episode. So Jon Stewart in here calls Booster by the name Buster and even acknowledges that he knows it's wrong. You know, he just doesn't care. But it fits really nicely with the TV episode, which, again, was written after this, where Booster gets called Green Lantern. You know, it's like... the wrong names is kind of cute. It's also worth pointing out, I want to mention the last page. So the last page is a flyer for the Super Dudes, which of course, you know, is got to be a nod to the Super Buddies. I mean, it has to be, because this was done after that. So it has to be. But also, this page was redrawn. So it turns out Christopher Jones drew it and did hand lettered a bunch of stuff. And for whatever reason, whether the letters, the inker was confused or the letter was confused, whatever, they came back and lettered it all, probably by computer, rather than all this hand stuff he did. He had a whole bunch of other jokes in there about time travel. It had Booster and Beetle's face in there. It was a lot more sort of handmade looking. And you can see that image over on the Boosterific website. They have that out there. Used to be on the Christopher Jones website, but his gallery appears to be down. But it's a really fun image. So it's just nice to know that he put a lot of effort into this last page flyer. It looks great.
Yeah, and you can tell it's just this flyer is just thumbtacked onto some community corkboard.
Right.
And they got the little pull tabs, you know, like guitar lessons you'd see, you know, at a one of those things. So that's a great thing to do there. I mean, obviously it must have failed because, you know, Booster never talks about it in the show. So
fair. Okay, so this thing was a hell of a lot of fun. I think that's fair to say, wouldn't you say, JT?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, this was great.
And while it doesn't fit directly in our JLI universe, I mean, the spirit of it's there. I mean, right? I mean, are you feeling it too?
Yep, oh yeah.
Okay. I kind of wish Martian Manhunter had been in it just because of the JLI connection, but either way.
Yeah, that would have been cool, but this definitely feels like, you know, our Blue Beetle, Booster Gold, you know, what we expect from the Blue or Gold. This is a great, yeah, it's not in our normal continuity, like you said, but I mean, who's even keeping track nowadays? You know, there's a multiverse, there's not. Come on.
Yeah. Well, I'm thrilled you brought this to my attention because, again, I had no idea this was an issue by Giffen was out here. So anyway. All right. Well, JT, this is the tough part of the show where you and I are going to have to nominate the
Wahaha Award.
This is where we're going to pick a single moment. Only one is going to be awarded the coveted Wahaha Award. What do you got, JT?
All right. So there were a couple of moments in this issue, as short as it is, as far as story and everything else, that did make me laugh. One made me actually laugh out loud. And again, we don't have page numbers here, but it's right when Blue Beetle and Booster Gold leap into action. They jump off the rooftop and, you know, Blue Beetle goes, consider it an impromptu audition. And Booster goes, not until you tell me what impromptu means. It's just so funny because, I mean, I have friends who will second guess me using a college level word, I guess. And it just really rang true. It was really funny.
Well, I think it was very fitting for the Booster Blue and Gold relationship, too. So, yeah, it's a great one. Mine's a little later. So they've met up with the Justice League. They've totally screwed up the Justice League, taking down the Demolition Team. The Demolition Team, for goodness sakes. So and they're explaining that they wanted to join the team. And the league's asking him about it. And Beetle says, you know, come on, you guys got to be raking it in. I figure product endorsement alone must be net you over. And Wonder Woman's incensed. She's like, endorsements? And he like nudges her with his elbow and he says, don't play coy with us. And she turns to Batman and says, I'm going to hit him. Hera, help me. I'm going to hit him. And just seeing Wonder Woman that pissed off cracked me up. With that said, this is a JLI podcast. And so Wonder Woman getting the joke, as much as I love it, it probably should go to Beetle and Booster.
I mean, I think that's a fair assessment. The Wonder Woman moment you talk about would be perfect for Power Girl in Justice League Europe, though.
Oh, yeah, would have been. Oh, that would have been perfect. Yeah, if you could slot her in here and make that story work that way, yeah. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so we're going to give it to Beetle and Booster for the definition of impromptu. So congratulations, guys. Blue and Gold, you are the winners of the Wahaha Award. Please wear it with pride. It is as tangible as our laughter. Now, JT, I got to ask a favor.
Yeah.
Would you mind hanging around here for a bit to ensure that Beetle and Booster don't try to break into anything like the Watchtower to impress Martian Manhunter? Because somehow I think that would go horribly wrong.
I'd love to do that. I see they already are leaving the grocery store with carts filled with Oreos.
go quick. Now, don't worry, JT. We will bring you back at the end of the show. After this podcast promo break, I'm going to catch up with the Injustice League over in DC Retroactive JLA The 90s.
Just imagine the mightiest heroes of our time.
All of them on one team.
Since there are so many of us, we have a chance to do more than just put out fires. We can be proactive. We can do some real good in the world.
JLU Cast brings you coverage of Justice League Unlimited, the ultimate gathering of DC's heroes and villains, and the culmination of the greatest interpretation of the DC Universe ever.
Join Chris and Cindy Franklin as they relive the team-ups, the battles, the conspiracies.
I had no idea that the Girl Scouts were responsible for the crop circle phenomenon.
Few people do. Few even think to ask the question.
The romance and the fun.
A head start. You're getting soft in your old age.
Don't you have a tall building to go leap?
And the adventure continues.
Find us wherever fine Fire and Water podcasts are available.
All right, folks, I'm here with our third co-host for this episode. This guest is a new visitor to the embassy, but he's been a friend to the show for years in the comments section. He also holds the prestigious title of incoming chairman of the board for the National Association of Doily Aficionados. Folks, please help me welcome to the show Mr. Brett Young. Welcome to the embassy, Brett. Thanks for being here, man. How you doing?
Thank you, Shag. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it. And I think like most children, my fascination with doilies started when I was very young. that's an obvious thing.
So you have to explain this to me. So the doilies has been something that has repeatedly shown up in the comic. Quite frankly, I just would have been happy to ignore all of your comments like forever. I don't care.
Well, I understand that. Sure.
Right. But then the doily stuff, you just kept going on and on about the doilies. And we've got a doily count and all this. And it took fire. And help me understand this fascination.
Right. So basically, I was trying to remember what issue. So I went back and looked. It was an Adam Hughes issue. It was JLI 51. Mm-hmm. In that issue, there's a few scenes of them in the embassy itself. And a lot of the furniture, the couch and the recliner had these big doilies on it and stuff like that. and then like all the couch and the recliner had skirting at the bottom too. And I just remember thinking, I was like, oh, that reminds me of my Nana's house. So I never noticed it before. Maybe that stuff was present earlier. I don't know, but I hadn't noticed it before. So I was like, oh, that's cool. So then I had already had a fixation with the checkerboard flooring.
Sure.
Which it started from issue one. Mm-hmm. It seemed like every time they were anywhere, there was always a checkerboard floor. So I kind of fixated on that and I started looking for it and I started fixating on the overall decor of everything. So that's kind of where it started. And then I started the count and then so you can thank Adam Hughes for me just running that joke into the ground.
I think the peak moment was the drawing you did of Despero with the doily as a loincloth. I think that was probably the peak doily count.
I think that's where I ended it too, because I was like, I can't go past that.
Right.
No,
right.
I'm not going to beat that. So I'll just end it here. Thank you.
Well, folks, we are going to cover today the story from 2011. There was a run of books called DC Retroactive, and one of them was JLA The 90s. And within it, there is a story, a new story from 2011, written by Giffen and DeMatteis with art by McGuire. It is basically designed to slot right into JLI continuity of the old days. This particular one features the Injustice League, and it's called Apocalypse No. And just like all the other Retroactive books, it actually includes a second story in the back, which is a reprint. So this one had the new story up front, and the backup story was JLA number 60, which we just covered last month, which was the final issue of JLA. It's kind of an odd one to pick, given that it's so steeped in what was going on in breakdowns, but it's still a great story, obviously a great issue. So Brett, you and I got talking beforehand, and we kind of come to the realization here that this story we're about to cover, this new story with the Injustice League, was the last JLI story ever done by Giffen, DeMatteis, and McGuire. 2011. Crazy.
Yeah, I know. Well, and it definitely will be at this point too, unfortunately.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, that's true. That's true. God, that was 12 years ago, 13 years ago.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
The Super Buddy stuff, like in my head, the Super Buddy stuff comes after this, but that's not the case. In continuity, it does.
Right.
Certainly, the Super Buddy stuff was pushing a new direction for those characters, whereas this is more about revisiting the original era. Yeah. And so, exactly. Super Buddies is 2003, 2005. So this is it, the last one. I should mention also the retroactive books came out between Flashpoint and the launch of New 52. It was kind of, I guess it was designed to help them, put a little buffer in there so they could get the New 52 up and running, even though they're still cranking out a ton of books. But somehow it was designed to help them with that. So either way, so I got to ask you, Brett, you talked about Adam Hughes and your love of issue 51 and all that, but how did you find the JLI? Like, what's your personal origin story? What made you fall in love with it?
So I was actually there from the ground floor. I bought issue one off the rack.
Oh,
I have the entire run from just month to month when they were coming out. So I was probably about 12 or 13 when Crisis started. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of like my, they always say that's around your golden age when you're, about 12 years old.
Oh, yeah.
So Crisis on Infinite Earths was mine. That was, I'd been reading comics even earlier when I was younger. But that's like, when my real love of comics really bloomed. So I remember that. And then, all the post-crisis changes with Burns, Superman, Perez on Wonder Woman, and Legends came out. And that led right into, probably two of my favorite comics ever, which was Ostrander's Suicide Squad and then the Justice League.
By the way, both came out in 1987, which is the single greatest comic publishing year of all time. And I will die on that hill. So. Go ahead, please.
No. You're probably right. I'd have to do some research on that, but that's right in my wheelhouse. So, by the way, real quick, speaking of Suicide Squad, I've heard you mention on the show a few times and other shows about your love of that Giffen Suicide Squad with Sergeant and everything. I have that collection. I have read that. I enjoyed it as well.
Isn't it awesome?
It always sounded like you were shouting into the void on that. Like nobody, everybody was always like, "What are you talking about?" But I've read it and you're right. I liked it too.
Thank you for the ringing endorsement. See, I'm not always wrong.
You're welcome. So that was, I immediately liked the tone of that book. It was right in my wheelhouse.
We're talking about JLI now, Suicide Squad, right?
Yes. Okay. I'm sorry. Yes.
No, that's okay.
Yes. No, thank you. I was pretty familiar with most of the characters. I knew all the, I knew about Earth 2 and I knew about the Justice Society. So I knew about Dr. Fate and stuff like that. And, I knew who Captain Marvel was. Or whatever you have to call him now. And, the only guy I didn't know that well was Guy Gardner. He was shown very briefly in Crisis, but I wasn't reading Green Lantern at the time, so I didn't know him very well. But obviously he became one of the big stars of that book. I even remembered Fire from when she was Green Fury in the Super Friends comic. I remembered all that. So, but I love the tone. I love the humor. It was just right in my wheelhouse. I thought it was great. I know that it was sort of a mixed bag for some people because they thought this shouldn't be funny. This is the Justice League. This is their flagship book and everything. But I thought it was great. And to the point where I remember when they eventually, after breakdowns, and I remember, I want to say it was Wizard Magazine or something. I read an article with Dan Jurgens, who was taking over. And I remember him just being like that. They were like, okay, well, we're, enough of the jokey stuff. This is going to be a serious book now. No more jokes, no more of that stuff. And I'm a big fan of Dan Jurgens, but that really bummed me out. I was like, I like this. It's fun. I guess I should have known it wasn't going to last forever, but it was almost like kind of Dean Wormer came in and took over the favorite book, no fun of any kind. He put the Justice League on double secret probation,
right?
So that kind of bummed me out, and I kept reading for a while, but I kind of gave up on that version of the Justice League kind of after the death of Superman and stuff like that. But that's that's afterwards. But I loved it from the start. It had some ups and downs. I think like some people, I wasn't too thrilled with some of the characters that came later. General Glory. I wasn't a big fan of that storyline, but overall it was great. I also have Justice League Europe. I read that all the way through. I just love the book. Still have them all. Don't plan on giving them up.
Aw. So. Well, that's great. And you and I came up about the same time, it sounds like, and a lot of similarities there. I foolishly stayed with Justice League. Unfortunately, like, there's this inertia thing. We were talking about this in a group online the other day. There's a comic book collecting inertia that just kind of happens with some of us. And I started collecting originally with the Detroit League. Then I missed the launch of JLI for various reasons I've talked about here on the show. And then I picked up around Justice League Europe, and then I rolled into JLA. So then from that point on, I just, that's what, 1990, I think, is when I finally started, you know, really every month. And I kept collecting it until 2015, every month. And there is some terrible eras in there. Let me tell you, I'm not going to point any fingers. I mean, I think everyone can figure out a few of them. Yeah. But I stick with it. And finally, in 2015, I was just like, I don't care anymore. And I finally broke the cycle and stopped. Now, I've read quite a bit on DC Unlimited since then. But as far as buying it every month, I was. And yeah, that inertia will get you, man.
Yeah, no, well, I mean, I came back to the book, you know, later on, you know, like when Grant Morrison took over and stuff like that. So, you know, I came back to the book, and I still read it today. And to be honest, there have been sort of some rough patches even recently. You know, it's been really up and down. But no, I understand the thing. You get to the point where you're like, why, you know, I feel like I'm burning $5 every month just, you know, just getting this for no reason.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Well, this, thankfully, the comic we're going to talk about right now is wonderful. This is super fun. It is intended to be a celebration of the previous JLI era that we just finished covering last month, really. But at this point, it's almost 20 years later, which is crazy. You know, so they finish issue 60. 20 years later, they do this. Almost 20 years later, they do this story, and it feels like they didn't miss a beat. So why don't we get into this? This is DC Retroactive, JLA the 90s, number one, published by DC Comics, cover dated October 2011, on the shelves August 24th, 2011. Cover price was $4.99. Ouch! Well, that's more modern for you. The cover is by Kevin freaking Maguire. Yeah, you want to describe it for us?
Yeah, it features the Injustice League, our classic Injustice League members from the JLI. So you have Major Disaster kind of standing in front with Clock King, Clue Master, Big Sur, and Multi-Man all standing in the classic JLI, you know, want to make something of it pose. But in this case, the camera sort of pulled back so you can see their entire bodies, and they're standing with all the defeated Justice League laying around them. So you have Guy Gardner, Power Girl, Beetle, Booster, Fire, Barda, who's not in it, Oberon, Rocket Red, who's not in it, Mr. Miracle, Ice, John, and Maxwell Lord. And then, you know, so it's sort of this big triumphant pose, and then they kind of clip their own wings with a word bubble, you know, admitting that this doesn't actually happen. We don't really beat them, but it's a heck of a cover, isn't it? So it's great. It's great.
Absolutely love this cover. It's so great. I mean, what a great way to take that classic JLI pose, right? You know, to work that in here. And I'm a sucker for a word balloon on a cover. And this one, particular one, is a riot. And I'm glad you pointed out Barda, because yeah, both Barda and Rocket Red are not in the issue itself, but I'm glad to see them on the cover. Although now in hindsight, it's the wrong Rocket Red armor for this period of time. He's wearing the classic Rocket Red armor, which is fine. I like that version better, actually.
That's true. I didn't think about that. Yeah, you're right. It's another, you know, Maguire doing another brilliant homage to himself, basically, you know, with the added bonus of pulling the camera back. I like that feature. Mm-hmm. You know, kind of gives it, turns on its head a little bit. And I have to say, with all artistic appreciation intended, I love the way that he has milked this cover design from JLI 2, and has done it over. And again, this is not sarcasm. This is deep appreciation that he's been able to milk so much out of that cover design. I think it's fantastic, and I hope he gets all the money in the world for doing that too. I think it's great. You know, as a designer, I wish I had that one design that I could just keep doing over and over and over and over. You know, and making a ton of money. I think it's fantastic, and good on him for it.
Well, the beauty is he still gets to do it. I mean, he's doing it in commissions. He's done some variant covers for different, you know, books here and there, and it's still this type of pose. So yeah, he's getting lots of mileage out of it.
Oh, sure. It's great. It's great.
So the one thing about this that kind of throws me off is, like, I'm not used to seeing Maguire's JLI with computerized coloring and shading and gradients and stuff like that. I don't know. Like, is it just me?
No, it's not just you. That threw me off too, and it throws me off throughout the book too. This was kind of some earlier digital coloring that I just don't think fit his style too well. you know, McGuire's kind of interesting because his art is sort of, it's detailed, but it's also very simple. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that, it's very clean lines. It's very open. And I think he works better, or certainly with the Justice League, he worked better in those flat colors.
Yeah.
Flat color palette. And it... I mean, they've obviously improved on this, but it almost looks like it's airbrushing. And there are parts, and we can talk about that when we get into the inside of this book, but there are parts that it really just kind of throws you off and looks out of place. And I think it was a little bit of a disservice to his art, to be honest with you. Not intentionally, because I know that they were still experimenting with this. You know, I don't have the historical records. I don't know when they started doing more of this, but that this particular style of coloring, you know, was it seemed like, or at least the colorist then seemed like a more simplistic way of doing this, the digital coloring. And I just don't think it worked well for him. But even that aside, I mean, McGuire's so good that he's able to overcome all that. But it still was, you know, yeah, threw me off too.
Yeah. And the thing is, digital coloring wasn't really new at this point. This is 2011. They were doing digital coloring in the mid 90s. So, I mean, it's an industry that's at least 15 years old. So I don't know whether it's the particular style they were doing on these issues,
yeah.
Or maybe it's just like you said, I've always kind of put McGuire in the category of a cartoonist. And I don't mean that in a derogatory way, but cartooning is what you do. And there is a certain cartoony element to his style because of the open spaces, mm-hmm. like you said. And I have no doubt when they did the JLI book that they chose to do flat colors on purpose. Because they, even back in the 80s, they still had the ability to do shading and gradients mm-hmm. and things mm-hmm. like that. And they chose not to. They did very flat colors in JLI. We used to talk about that when the podcast started 1,000 years ago, on how they chose flat colors on purpose. And I think it worked better. And I think it was a great look for that book. And it kind of, they carried it through even as the artists changed. So I don't want to dwell on it too much here. But yeah, it does, it throws me off here and it throws me off inside. Absolutely does.
Yeah.
I do have one other thing to say. Like, my name is the Irredeemable Shag. Okay? It's right there. I love to recognize a beautiful woman when I see one. Even I would say that Fire's pose on the cover, it's a bit much. She's laying on her back. She's got that classic original outfit of Fire costume. And it's just, anyway, it's really accentuating certain attributes of hers that it's just a bit much.
Well, I'm going to have a slight counterpoint to you here.
Okay.
Who is the most scantily clad person on this cover?
Normally the gut instinct would be Fire, but truthfully, it's Martian Manhunter.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. I mean, and he's kind of in this sort of almost damsel in distress pose as well.
That's true.
That's the one thing about him. I've always like John. I think you know, he worked great as sort of the straight man in this book, the Martin to the Lewises, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But he was always basically walking around in briefs and buccaneer boots and a cape. And you know, nobody was ever like, really? Then we're not going to say anything about this? You know,
put a shirt on, man.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, do something. So that's every time I know what you're saying about Fire, but when I saw that in the notes and I was like, yeah, but what about John here?
Yeah,
so
it's fair.
That's the only thing I would say about that. But you are right about Fire, about the prone pose she's in.
There's two things to it. There's the sexy victim trope, which is not good. The other side is, quite honestly, if she's wearing that outfit, that is how her breasts would fall. I mean, that is that is accurate. So anyway, we spend way too much time on this.
It's accurate. And Booster found a good place to fall as well.
Oh my Lord. That's fairly appropriate for him. All right.
Yeah, it is. Anyway.
Well, let's get inside here. So again, the first half is this new story, Apocalypse No. The back half is a reprinted JLI 60. We're not going to spend any time on JLI 60 because we just did it. But for Apocalypse No, it is a 26-page story from 2011. Plot and breakdowns by Keith Giffen. Script by J.M.D. Mateus. Penciler and inker is Kevin McGuire. Letter is Carlos Manguel. Colorist is Rosemary Cheatham. Assistant editor is China Clugston Flores. And editor is Jim Chadwick. All right, so I'm going to give a quick recap of the story here. It's got a lot going on, but I'll try and recap it as quickly as possible. So the story opens at the supervillain hangout called the Darkseid Bar, which we've seen many times before. There we start with Multi-Man of the Injustice League. He's playing a high-stakes game of poker against a vacationing parademon. Yes, you heard me correctly. So once the Parademon's out of cash, he wagers some Apocalyptium thingamabob, which Big Sur desperately wants because it's shiny. Mm-hmm. So Big Sur is then infected by the Apocalyptium thingamabob, which is actually a Parademon meta booster, which is filled with Apocalyptium DNA. Big Sur then finds himself transforming into this four-story tall lumbering monster. Coincidentally, of course, Guy Gardner and Mr. Miracle are monitoring and following the Parademon just in case this is like a precursor to an invasion. But no, it's just a drunk tourist, Parademon, who's idiotically unleashed a possible Apocalyptian plague on the streets of New York. Try saying that five times fast. Guy and Mr. Miracle, they warn the rest of the JLI, which interrupts Fire and Ice's shopping trip. The quartet then are joined by Martian Manhunter, Booster Gold, Blue Beetle, and Power Girl, and together the JLI work to stop Big Sur from wrecking the city. Meanwhile, the Injustice League watches and debates turning over a new leaf and becoming heroes. Of course, this doesn't go well for the Injustice League, as the obnoxious Guy Gardner notices them, shoots first, and asks questions later. Eventually, the day is saved as Power Girl's cat is accidentally thrown into the mouth of Big Sur, apparently causing some sort of allergic reaction that results in Big Sur's body rejecting the Parademon's DNA or something like that, and he returns to normal. Later, Guy Gardner taunts the Injustice League because they want to be heroes. Guy sarcastically offers to talk to Maxwell Lord on their behalf about the Injustice Leaguers becoming the newest branch of the JLI in Antarctica. The final page features the League flying off into the sunset with the caption, "That's all, folks." There we go. That is the final JLI story by our original creators. What'd you think, man?
Oh, I loved it. I mean, I know we talked about this a little bit before we started recording. It's if this was to be their last story, it was a great way to end. You know, it was funny. It was interesting. It was entertaining. You know, they nailed it. You know, the art was great. The writing was great. The plotting was quick and kept moving. It was terrific. It was terrific.
I love this thing. It's like it's got, first of all, it's hilarious, right? Mm-hmm. But it's got so many of the JLI tropes. I mean, it is the perfect tribute to the classic JLI. Now, reading it today, as we're doing with the podcast, I mean, I just read issue 60 last month. So reading this, it, you know, I could just say it's more of the same. But if you put it in the frame of it, which is where the, you know, in 2011, where the readers, it's been almost 20 years since the original JLI, and it's been 6 years since the last Super Buddy story. And again, Super Buddies was kind of a different animal. They hit all the great tropes. You know, the Injustice League's trying to be good. It's got the dark side bar, monitor duty, Power Girl's cat's the thing, you know, Fire and Ice shopping. There's so much callback. You know, John's frustrated, wants to go meditate, Guy being an ass, you know, they even took nods to other stuff, like the friendly character who gets turned into a giant monster, you know, that happened in Justice League Quarterly with Ice. There's great banter throughout this thing. It just feels like the perfect celebration of that era, and I couldn't have asked for anything better.
Yeah. And just even the way it starts, I mean, we always talk about the 9-panel grid. Here you got like, what, 16 panels?
Yes!
On here, the faces. And the storytelling, I mean, McGuire's, I think, a master at storytelling and acting on the page, I guess. The tight shots of Multiman's face and Parademon's face, and you go through the banter there, and then it pulls out to show you, you know, them sitting at the poker table at the dark side bar. And the dark side bar is fantastic.
Yes. You
know, it's such a great trope. I love it whenever it's introduced. I know they use it in different ways now. I don't know. I think they have different names for the bars now, so I don't know if they always use it. But anyway, but yeah, the dark side bar, it's a great name for the bar. It's a perfect name. It's a great trope. And I was going to get back to that in just a minute. But I do want to just say, as far as the storytelling went, I loved that after you pull back and you see where they are, you see they're playing poker and everything, then the camera angle sort of is rotating around the table. So you kind of see it from Multiman's point of view, then you see it from the Parademon's point of view, and then you kind of see a little bit of a side view and everything. So it feels like you're sitting at the table playing with them. I just thought that was a brilliant way of storytelling to handle that.
Well, what an effective way to, I hadn't even thought about that. You're right. They literally, it's almost like every panel, they're in a different chair around the table. You're right. Yeah. Yeah, really well done. I hadn't even noticed that. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and then of course, as far as the dark side bar goes, I was trying to figure out who all the villains and everything were in the background.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I got a few, you can see Crazy Quilt. Looks like he's talking to a bartender or a waitress who has her, has a bunch of like bills stuffed in her chest.
Yeah.
And I think if you look on one of the panels after that, it looks like he's getting slapped by her too.
Oh, wow. Okay. You know, fun. All right.
Look, it's,
yes. Yes, he is. You're right. Yeah.
So it looks like, and that's Calendar Man talking to Polka Dot. Is that Polka Dot Man, or
nope.
Is that somebody else?
That is Dr. Spectro, a villain from Captain Atom.
Oh, okay. Okay. I tried to do this without looking up anybody.
Okay.
So, okay. Dr. Spectro. Okay. Wow. I don't know that one. And that's Kite Man, right?
So, oh, yeah, it is. Yes, he is.
Yeah. His colors are different. I don't remember him wearing like lighter colors like that. I thought he always wore green, but maybe I'm just conflating him with the way he is in Harley Quinn now.
I don't remember, but he's got a kite on his chest. It's Kite Man.
Yeah, it's Kite Man. I think that's the turtle on the other side of him.
Correct.
Okay. Then the ten-eyed man.
Okay.
At the table as well. You can see the ventriloquist in the background.
Yep.
It looks like the Rainbow Raider is talking to Psycho Pirate.
Yep.
And then you can see Killer Moth is watching, I think it's Knockout, making out with Zebra Man.
I would not have even noticed that one if you hadn't pointed it out to me. Yeah, because it's very subtle, because there's even a word balloon over it. But if you really,
yeah,
Knockout is totally got Zebra Man pinned to a wall and they are making out.
And then there's a big guy in yellow with goggles. I don't know who that is.
I struggle with that one. I had to do a little online research. I don't think I have the answer. I mean, it looks like either maybe Dr. Double X, but without the fin, like the mohawk. The colors are very double Dr. Double X-ish. It's also kind of like Captain X, but he wasn't a bad guy. So I don't have an answer on that one.
Yeah. I mean, he looks like a big bruising guy, too. It's huge.
Yeah.
And then the short guy, I think I saw in your note. Is that Dr. Psycho?
Yeah, that's Dr. Psycho.
Psycho. Okay. All right.
But I love whenever they do the Dark Side bar and they throw all the cameos in the background. It just makes me so happy.
Yeah, I know. It's great. It's great. I love it. And, you know, the Injustice League is fantastic. I love how ridiculous they are. Their costumes, most of them look like they made them themselves. I mean, Clock King's cape looks like a bed sheet tied around his neck. I mean, Multi-Man's basically walking around in like a, you know, briefs and a sleeveless shirt with a giant collar.
Yep.
And they're trying to be incognito. They're trying to hide out, and they're all just wearing their costumes all the time in full, which is just terrific. They're a bunch of morons.
But don't forget the best costume of all, the Mighty Bruce.
Yes, of course.
He's just, you know, t-shirt and jeans, and you can even see he's got holes in his socks where his toes are poking through. That's a little Kevin Maguire detail there.
Yeah, I didn't notice that. That's great.
I will say Clock King's mask, though, is always is a favorite. I just love that he's looking through like a Timex face. It's just the best always.
It's awesome. And then, you know, that leads into where the Parademon gets thrown out of the bar. Miracle and Guy are supposed to be, you know, following this guy, and Guy immediately just slams him into a wall. I love the elephant foot is great.
You know,
he uses that to slam him.
Well, and that's perfect too, because they're trying to be subtle. So, you know, what's the least subtle thing you can think of is an elephant. So, of course, Guy goes that way, right?
Exactly. You know, and then followed by, you know, one of Maguire's hallmarks is the continuous panels where the action's happening off screen, you know, but it just leads to, it's funnier that way. You know, if they showed him beating it up, it wouldn't be as funny, you know, but the fact that Miracle's talking, you know, and kind of concerned about this, and then you see the Parademon fly in, it's just, you know, it's brilliantly done.
I hadn't thought about that. You're right. That's another JLI trope. That's a great one. Yeah. It's so, again, this comic is freaking hysterical. It's so funny.
Yeah. And then it sort of, at this point, kind of flips from being an Injustice League centric book story to a Justice League centric book.
Yeah, that's fair.
It kind of goes from them back to the heroes.
Yep.
You know, it's kind of like, okay, this is their show, so let's get them involved. You know, I thought that was great. You know, they again, you're kind of being reintroduced to all your favorites. You know, you see Beetle, you see John, you see Oberon, you know, you see Fire and Ice. The one thing, going back to the coloring, is it drives me nuts the way they're doing Ice's hair in this.
Oh.
Because it's sort of just like an outline. It almost looks like a longer Dutch boy haircut.
Yeah.
With the inking, and then the color lines are too light. So it just looks like a mass. I don't know.
I think he's trying to go for like a fluffy snowbank is maybe what he's trying to go for. And also, Maguire didn't get a chance to draw Fire and Ice very much. I mean, by the time he left the book, they were just kind of coming on the team. I mean, Fire hadn't even developed her fire powers when he left the book. So, I mean, he had drawn them since then, like Super Buddies and issue 60 and stuff like that. But yeah, so he's probably still feeling out those characters a little bit, maybe.
Yeah, that's true. Do you like the way he does Fire's hair?
I'm torn on it. Like, I first of all, it's Kevin Maguire, so I'm not going to say a bad thing, right? It's like, you know, however Kevin Maguire chooses to interpret it, oh, that's fine with me. But I think I like it better, like Adam Hughes style, you know, just voluptuous, beautiful hair rather than very kinky, tight, defined curls is how he draws it, how Kevin draws it.
Yeah, I didn't know if he was kind of going for it to look like sort of licks of flame.
Oh, okay.
You know, it almost has like a Medusa quality to it, too.
Yes.
You know, like it's alive.
Mm-hmm.
And since that's kind of how she propels herself. Yeah, or sort of, doesn't she? I mean, well, I guess she doesn't. I don't know. I just always think of the flame, you know, her hair kind of becoming a big flame, and that sort of being, you know, when they do the flight lines.
Sure. Sort of like Starfire does.
So it's almost has like a, like an alive, like it's alive, like the hair's alive. So.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Anyway. Well, I like it more when he draws her in the fire mode, and little flicks of flame are coming off of her hair. I love that. I think it looks fantastic in flaming mode.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but I mean, overall, I mean, the comedy's great. Drunken Parademon. Shorter than I thought a Parademon would be. the whole run of like sexist stereotype, and then they're like, it's true too, you know, kind of running, that's the running joke of the, you know, they hit that two or three times.
Well, there's two of them. There's that when someone says that's a sexist stereotype and the other person says it's true. The other one is someone says thank you and the other person says that wasn't a compliment. Those are both really great running banter. I love those bits.
Yeah. You know, like Beatles sort of downplaying the seriousness of this is Miracle's getting more and more upset. And then, of course, you know, that brilliant page where he's alerting the team of what's going on when the, you know, after Big Sur turns into the giant Parademon, you know, he's a bit frazzled. Then he sees the cat and is in abject terror. And he sees, I guess we didn't even bring up the cat yet, so I guess we should do that.
But, yeah, so I didn't really get into the heavy details of it, but yeah, so Power Girl comes over to the embassy and she brings her cat with her. And everyone is terrified, from Oberon to Booster to Beetle, they're all like, you're terrified of the cat. And so this is where I put on my JLI podcast for 8 years hat and get a little, you know, well, you know, actually kind of thing. The timing of this story, unfortunately, doesn't work. I don't care, though. Okay, to make it perfectly clear, everything I'm about to talk about is nitpicky details, but I don't care. It's so good. It is absolutely fits in the spirit of the JLI of this area. And if you squint, the problems don't matter. But the specifics are, this story is supposed to take place after the cat is introduced in JLA 37 and whatever the Justice League Europe issue was. So, and it's supposed to take place before Justice League Annual number 4, which is when the Justice League Antarctica stuff happens, right? And that's pretty much like it goes 37, 38, and then the annual. It's right there. However, the timing doesn't work because at this point, Power Girl already has the cat. But by the time she had the cat, Booster had quit the JLA and Mr. Miracle had been replaced by a robot. So, again, if you get super nitpicky, it doesn't work. If you squint, it doesn't matter. And who cares? It's just fun. It's just so much fun.
Yeah, I think your second point is the right one. Put your hat away and enjoy the ride because it doesn't matter.
Yeah. And another nitpicky issue is Power Girl does fly in this issue. And at this point, she had been injured and had surgery. She could, you know, just the old Golden Age Superman kind of, you know, leap a tall building in a single bound kind of thing. And what you guys don't know is Brett and I just edited out about 3 minutes of us trying to remember that line about Superman leaping a tall building. And so we have to give back our geek card. But anyway, you just squint and it's fine. Who cares? It's just so much fun. And it absolutely captures that era, which probably honestly is the peak era of JLA, I think, is right around that area. When Adam Hughes is drawing it, you know, it's right in the 37, 38 kind of era. You know, the Justice League Antarctica is ramping up. It's all just perfect. Yeah. And I'm glad you mentioned the cat. It's hysterical.
Yeah, it's great. I'm not a big cat person, but I think the way they use this cat is great.
And they named the cat Theodore in here because, I mean, Power Girl's had several names for the cat over the years, but Theodore because of Ted, which is hysterical. Right.
That's awesome. That's awesome. And then maybe my favorite page is, I think it's page 11, where Beetle's at monitor. I guess he's at monitor duty.
Yes, he is.
Yeah. And then so, like, you know, he's calling in and he refers to it as Darkseid's inhaler. the thingamabob that they lost and everything, and he's screaming, it's not his inhaler, you know, that it could doom the planet and everything like this. And then Max's mug, take it to the Max.
Yes. I got to talk about this page, all right, because this is my single favorite page in the book, and I'm showing my hand for something we're going to discuss in a minute. But so Beetle's on monitor duty, and like they're reporting to him that the parademon is just a drunk tourist and it's not an invasion, and Beetle is so upset. He's got his, and this is all down to McGuire's body language, right? And that whole off-screen thing you're talking about, because you can't see Mr. Miracle's side of the conversation, you just hear it. Beetle's literally got his hand on his face like he's bored. Then he's got his finger on his chin. I mean, he is, first of all, distraught that it's not an invasion, because he wanted that invasion. He's distraught because he doesn't get to play. They're getting into all the work. And then, like you said, he's not even listening to them. They're telling him it's this, you know, what is it called? Apocalyptian meta booster for parademons. And he just keeps calling it Darkseid Inhaler. He doesn't care. And it's just a freaking riot, this page.
That's great.
Now, that does lead to a line I got to mention, too, which is, you know, Max says, we're on it. And then Mr. Miracle says to Max, you know, it's good to know there's one person on this team I can trust. That is, in 2011, that has got to be a dig on, obviously, Maxwell Lord turning evil. That is absolutely by the creators trying to make a point there.
I think it's their way of flashing a middle finger to the people who ruined Maxwell Lord's character.
Yeah. It's either a middle finger or just acknowledging it because it's kind of funny. I mean, one way or another.
I'm going the mean-spirited way on this.
Okay, that's fair.
Because that is one part of DC continuity I refuse to admit still exists. I don't even know if it still does. Did that even technically happen anymore?
I don't know, because I'm not reading.
I mean, Ted Kord's alive.
Exactly. I was going to say, Ted Kord's alive now, so I'm not entirely sure, because I read some DC comics, but not any of the ones where Ted's been in recently, so I don't actually know. Oh, well, let us know in the comments, folks. Did Maxwell Lord still shoot Ted in the head and Ted just got better, or did something happen? We got to talk about something real quick. Like, how polished Kev McGuire has become by this point. I mean, every panel is perfect.
It's gorgeous.
He's inking himself, so that's probably part of it. But I do wonder how much time it took him. Like, could he crank this? I don't think he can crank this out monthly. This probably took him longer than that. Because every panel is perfection. You know, old McGuire was, obviously we all love him, but not every panel is perfection. Sometimes a panel is just a panel. Here, every panel is a piece of art. And it's just amazing.
Yeah, it's brilliant. I'm a big fan of his. I would probably put him on my Mount Rushmore. And I'm not saying that's as a fan. I'm not saying like, oh, he brought the most to the industry, you know, blah, 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 and everything like that. If I'm just looking at it as artists who, when you see their name or you see that they're doing on something, that gets you excited and you need to buy it. I mean, he's definitely on my Mount Rushmore in that, because he's just, you know, he came out almost a finished product. I mean, with JLI 1, I mean, Justice League 1, I mean, was his first published work.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's insane.
Right.
You know, and he only got better as he went. You're right. I don't think he's a particularly fast artist, like you mentioned. So I think that's one of the reasons he's never really done any sort of long runs on a book since Justice League, has he?
I mean, he's done a few things here and there. Usually it's more miniseries where he has more time.
So, but I don't care. I mean, I think he's fantastic. One thing, just while I'm thinking about it, on the big splash page, speaking about his art and how great it is, on the big splash page where Big Sur's the parademon, the giant parademon. Is that the toilet seat that's flying in the air behind him?
It's got to be, because there's even a quote on there that says he took the damn toilet with him. That's got to be the toilet seat.
That's I'm a moron. Okay.
No, you're not a moron at all.
I didn't even see that text bubble. Okay.
But that's just a perfect example of the text and the art working together perfectly. I mean, it's just because on the panel before, they're looking for the toilet, and then here he's roaming through the city, and there's just in the background a tiny little, you know, horseshoe looking thing in the air, which has got to be it.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. You know, the parademon, it's not like he's not detailed, but it's also so open and clean, the lines and everything. It's just, it doesn't get lost in the building behind it. He was smart enough when he was drawing the buildings behind the parademon in that page to, okay, I don't have to show every brick on this building or something like that. Let's just show the basic structure of the buildings, add the windows, and that's all you need. So it doesn't like interfere with it, because it's all kind of, you know, this is sort of monotone page, not completely, but it, you know.
The crazy thing is, though, look at the parademon's body and the incredibly detailed, like, he drew like a maze, essentially, all all over the body, like incredibly detailed, which must have been maddening and took an hours to do is all I can imagine.
Sure. And he doesn't short it with the other pages either. He keeps doing it.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like he does it once and he's just like, oh, I'll just, you know, but yeah, it's brilliant stuff. Yeah. He's great.
It's just lovely stuff. Again, super fun. And, you know, the guys are hot and muscle bound. The girls are gorgeous and sexy. I mean, there's one page of ice where in kind of a Marilyn Monroe thing where you're behind her and her skirt's blowing up. And I mean, consistently, I always thought the artist drew ice more sexy than fire. And I hear it continues. It's super great. I love later when Guy captures the Injustice League, he traps him inside a pinata. It took me a while to figure out what it is, but he traps him inside a pinata. And then he's hitting the pinata with a stick. And it's like, they don't make a big point of it. It's just sort of there. And it's hilarious that he's just beating them over and over.
Mm-hmm. I didn't notice that at first either until you pointed that out. Yeah. That was great. Yeah. It's fantastic. So as far as like the comedy bits too, we're coming up on the one where he gets terrified by the cat. But when the parademon first starts rumbling around, you see fire and ice walking outside doing their shopping, and they see it. They turn around, see him walk by, and then fire's immediately like, "So Bergdorf's next." You know, she just wants to just pretend that didn't happen.
Yep. Fire wants to keep going shopping. That was one weird story beat where fire didn't want to go shopping. I thought that was odd, but ice did. You know, it still worked out kind of
yeah.
fun. But
yeah.
I want to talk about the coloring for just one more second. We talked earlier about the coloring, and I don't want to harp on the digital coloring. One thing I've noticed, I have the physical copy as well as I'm reading the copy on DC Unlimited, and it is astonishing how much of the coloring got sucked up by the papers, physical paper. Yeah, it is like the main story is fine, but all the detail Kevin put in the background, like all those characters in Darkseid Binds bar and stuff like that, you almost can't see them in the physical comic. Yeah, and now maybe it's because this comic's 12 years old and the paper's just aged in that way. Right. I don't know. But the backgrounds are so much clearer in the digital version that I highly recommend, folks, if you're going to read this, and you should read the digital version rather than the paper version, because it's just, you miss so much in the paper version. I wouldn't even, like, you almost can't even tell that one moment where you talked about Knockout making out with Zebra Man. You almost can't even see it. It's so dark.
Oh, that's too bad.
Yeah.
That's too bad. Well, the paper was better at that point, too. That's a shame.
Yeah.
The other thing I wanted to point out, the one thing is that they sort of, the end of the story, more or less, that you never actually see Big Sur change back or anything like that. You know this at?
Oh, good point.
He kind of goes down. Miracle's standing on top of him, still as a monster, to see if he's dead or not, see if there's any blood. And they're like, no. I'm like, okay, well, I guess he's fine. So you never really know what happens to him after that. Does he change back?
There's a little bit in the dialogue where Mr. Miracle says, you know, he's rejecting the DNA. And he says, I can get the new Genesis medics to easily undo this. And the plague is averted. Okay. So, I mean, that's... You don't see it happen, but he basically says it's going to happen. But yeah, then they all fly away. So it is sort of like you still left a monster unconscious in downtown New York that's not fixed yet. But you had to have the moment of them flying off in the sunset, which is exactly what you want. If this is the last time we're ever going to see this league, I want to see them fly off to the sunset.
Absolutely.
It's cute that in a Warner Brothers owned property, they've got Porky Pig's line of that's all, folks, which is adorable. And it's a gorgeous last page. If this is the last thing we're ever going to see of the JLI, now we've seen covers and stuff like that since then, but if this is the last page of a story, then yeah, I'm fine with it. You know, don't get hung up on the joke, you know, of the monster. This is the way it should end.
Yeah, no, it's a terrific last image. And it's great, even though they're already over the embassy, so I'm not sure where they're going. But that doesn't matter. This is it's a great image, and that's what matters.
Exactly.
And, it's a great way to end it. And like I said, it's a nice farewell love letter and everything else to a great, you know, kind of a great era of the Justice League.
My favorite era.
I think now has kind of come around and getting, you know, I know you spoke on that before. It's kind of getting more of its appreciation now, which is nice.
Yeah, it took forever. I mean, you had from like, I don't know, 92 to probably 2003. Well, that's 10 years where people hated it. And then once they finally did the Super Buddy stuff, everyone's kind of like, oh, this stuff's actually pretty good. And so now it's finally celebrated again.
Yep. Yep. So the only other thing I noticed is that Fire Price should have been sidelined on this thing. I mean, she got knocked on the head pretty good, and Ice was trying to tell her to stand down.
But yeah.
As we all know, you know, concussions, that's a serious situation, as most football fans know. I mean, I think even Florida State fans should know that.
Too soon.
Do they still have a team?
Too soon. No? Too soon. Okay. Don't all get right. me started on that. That was low. That was low, sir. Just want to point that out. But it was funny. That's all that matters. All right. Speaking of funny, this is the point where we need to nominate the
Pwahaha Award.
In this, both myself and Brett are going to pick one moment, and only one is going to be awarded the coveted Bwahaha Award. Brett, you are the guest, which is unfortunate for me, at least. Could you please tell me your nomination for the Bwahaha Award?
Well, I think we might be on the same page on this one, actually.
Literally the same page, it sounds like.
Yeah, literally the same page. I believe it's page 11, the back and forth with Beetle on monitor duty, where he's going back and forth with Miracle, and then Max comes in with the take it to the max mug.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, obviously, if you just want to boil all the brilliance of that page down into two words, it's Darkseid's inhaler.
Yeah.
I think that's it.
We're right on the same page. That is perfect. That is absolutely for me. And it was tough because there's a lot of funny stuff. I mean, the reactions to the cat are hilarious. You know, Ice calling Guy Darren Gardner, you know, reminding us all that Guy Gardner and Darren Sutherland share a name. You know, Guy calling the mother box Mommy Thingamabob, which is hilarious. I mean, just line after line, the callback jokes we made. One of my favorites is super subtle when Guy Gardner shows up to the Injustice League to beat the crap out of him. He yells, Banzai! And Multiman points to...
Oh, yes.
Multiman points to Major Disaster and yelling, hit him first! Hit him first!
Yeah, that's a great
so
line.
So funny. But yes, this is the absolute winning page. So, congratulations to Blue Beetle and Darkseid's inhaler. You are the winner of the Bwahaha Award. Please wear it with pride. It is as tangible as our laughter for that moment.
Yes. Yes. Brilliant.
Now, Brett, I got to ask a favor. Would you mind hanging around here at the embassy and start the paperwork to establish the Justice League Antarctica embassy that Guy is suggesting this? I'm sure the Injustice League will do a fine job and make us all proud. Would you mind hanging around and taking care of that?
Oh, yeah. Well, fortunately, I didn't go to a Florida state, so I know where Antarctica is. So I think I can at least start this paperwork, so that should be okay.
Wow!
I feel like I got taken on the tail end of this whole podcast, just so I can help with cleanup. Is that basically what this is? At this point,
absolutely. I also want you to dust all the doilies while you're here, if you don't mind. I mean, those things collect dust like you wouldn't believe. So someone's got to do it. You're the guy for it.
I hope you have a nice I hope you have a nice duster.
I do have a nice duster. His name is Brett. Now, don't worry, Brett. We will bring you back at the end of the show, and we'll. Brett is taking care of all the dusting for us. I am going to read your listener feedback in a segment called
Justice Log.
All right, folks, before we get into your feedback, I do have just one follow-up comment on that discussion we had on DC Retroactive. You know, we said several times the DC Retroactive story was the last JLA story written by the Giffen DeMatteis McGuire team. Now, before you all chime in on the comments, I do realize that Justice League 3000 and Justice League 3001 came out after 2011. However, while I love those series and they're lots of fun, they're not really a JLI book. I mean, they're certainly JLI adjacent, but that story is trying to tell something different. So I don't feel like those are truly JLI stories. So I just wanted to clarify that point before I get roasted in the comments. So, all right. Now, remember, we want your feedback. So get on the social media. Tag us at JLI Podcast. As I always say, it is about building a community of online JLI fans around the show. And remember, when you're posting, if you're outside the United States, let me know and we'll assign you the appropriate embassy. Now, right now, I'm going to dig into your comments from last episode, which was Justice League America number 60 with my guest Joe Casey. And that was a kind of a big deal, that episode, because that was finishing up the original Giffen De Matteis run. So got a lot of feedback from a lot of folks congratulating us on completing the first, you know, the major chunk of what we're going to do. So that was awesome. So thank you so much to everyone. But because there is so much feedback, like usual, I'm going to be just pulling comments from our website, in email, social media, things like that, and just reading bits and pieces so that we can get through all this and just also recognize everyone who left us a comment. So thank you. First up, we've got Doug Adamson from the Scottish Embassy. He says, it was great to have Joe Casey on the show again. He's one of my favorite writers. And his views, particularly about how this felt like the end of an era, as Image was about to hit, in retrospect, certainly rang true to me. Now, as to the issue itself, I was blown away by the Chris Sprouse cover, and part of me wishes that it was used instead of the Kevin Maguire's. You know, Ice's hair alone looks so much better. You know, Doug, I kind of get what you're saying there, that I do love that Chris Sprouse piece. And, you know, last episode, I made a plea to someone to do a digital coloring version of that so we could see it. Thank you so much to everyone listening that did not follow through on that, so I might have to do that myself. I'm going to pull a Thanos. Then Doug goes on to say, the rest of the issue was also pitch perfect for finishing the run and also setting up what I and many others expect to be a major rebuilding effort. And while Justice League Spectacular was great and the lineup that follows was interesting, honestly, I had much higher hopes after this ending, and what we got was, I don't know, a disappointment, especially Justice League Europe. Yeah, Doug, completely agree. Then we heard from Gus Casals from our Argentina embassy. He does podcasts such as Ian Reed's Crisis and Alfred Pennyworth Presents podcast and much more. He says, first of all, well done, Shag. I know there's further paraphernalia to come, but you set to cover the whole run and you did it. We are so used to, just not in the podcastosphere, but in comics in general, the thing's not ending, not being completed, or at least not by the same creative team. Now, having your massive 8-year project completed and only getting better and better over time is huge. Take a bow, have a cookie, it might just be a Choco. Well, thank you, Gus. It's very kind of you to say. And he says, agreed on most of the points Joe and you made, and I did get emotional several times over the book, not just the last page. And it says, P.S. loved the Keith Giffen talk at the beginning, and as the guy who made the 5 years later podcast, I cannot thank you enough for the lengthy off-topic. Wink, wink. Glad you enjoyed that, Gus. And yeah, having a chance to talk to Joe about his first-hand experience working with Keith and just celebrating Keith like that, it was really an incredible opportunity. So, yeah. Then we're from Buffalo DeLorean. It says, I wonder if Catherine Colbert made it into Young Justice, the cartoon, because of her connection to Captain Atom. Greg Weisman was the creator of that show and one of the writers on Captain Atom's Justice League Europe adjacent solo book. Wow, that could be the connection we've all been wondering. So good detective work, Buffalo DeLorean. Then we're from Bucky749, who has his own YouTube channel. He says, great show, great guest, and only one quote comes to mind. Often imitated, but never duplicated. I like that. Then Bucky says, a wonderful comic book, and I have to think that Blue Beetle got the best ending. All right, interesting. I like that. It certainly is a hilarious one for him there. Then we heard from Liz Ann Oswald, who has her own YouTube channel. Liz says, the cover's cool, but I'm sorry, I must disagree. Kevin Maguire's cover looks better to me. The expression on John and Guy's faces look perfect for them, and Fire and Ted's faces as well. Then she says, the Sprouse's art is great, as is the body language, and how well he planned out the page with the flags and all. It's just I like Maguire's better. Hey, that is a perfectly valid opinion, Liz. And then Liz goes on to say about Elongated Man and Sue, she looks great with a ponytail. If she stood next to Catherine Colbert in this look, you could tell them apart. And also their banter is on point. Couples talk like this, though the sad moment is, oy, having read Identity Crisis first, this hits harder. Ugh. Absolutely true. Absolutely true. And yeah, about the art, I do love how they were able to make Catherine and Sue look different, even though they're both, you know, non-powered women who work at the embassy and just wear regular clothes. And yet they managed to make them look different. That is a tribute to the artistry and the distinction they made between the characters. Then we'll hear from Chris Franklin from the Fire and Water Podcast Network. He does shows such as JLUcast, and he recently guest appeared on my Once Upon a Geek podcast discussing What If. Chris says, great discussion, fellas. Joe was a great guest, of course, and some wonderful insight on Keith Giffen. I don't think I fully appreciated Giffen until all this posthumous accolades kept pouring in, especially from fellow creators. He may be mainstream comics' second greatest idea man this side of Jack Kirby. He's certainly the top five. You know, I hadn't thought of any kind of ranking, Chris, but that, you might be onto something there. And then Chris says, not gonna lie, at this time, I preferred the direction change with JLA under Peter Jurgens at the time. I still think it's a great run, but so was this one. And time has proven that JLI has been more influential and memorable. Oh, yeah. Well, it's nice to hear some validation for me sticking up for this era for 8 years. Thanks, Chris. Then we hear from Jason R. Lady, author of the young adult humorous fantasy adventure novels Monster Problems, Super Problems, and Time Problems. Jason says, something to point out. The only characters to make it through the entire run all the way from JL number 1 to JLA number 60 are Jean, Guy, and Beetle. I hadn't thought about that. He says, it makes sense. I feel like, if anyone, those are the three Giffen DeMatteis truly defined and left their mark on. Oh, yeah, absolutely. I agree with that, Jason. Then he goes on to say, I will echo what others have said. It's a shame that for this swan song, we didn't get Booster Gold, Mr. Miracle, or Barda appearances, not to mention Nort. All of them were major parts of this book, especially Booster and Miracle, for a long time. Booster's practically synonymous with the JLI. And that has been a hot topic throughout the comments, is, you know, the inclusion or non-inclusion of certain members in the final issue. And a lot of people feel strongly on both sides. Then Jason goes on to say, Mr. Casey is right. The team of characters not being used anywhere else and not a major IP is a writer's dream, because they can do whatever they want and explore and develop the cast in ways they could never do otherwise. Many of my favorite team books are like this. Fabian Nieceva's New Warriors, Peter David's X-Factor, even the West Coast Avengers and Harris and Epstein's Avengers. I'd rather read those books any day versus the 9,875th Justice League that also stars Superman, Batman, and Wonder Woman. I agree with you completely. My favorite teams are always the underdogs, the ones that nobody wants to publish. Then we're here from Tim Price from the Outcasters Batman and the Outsiders podcast and the Batgirl Huntress podcast. Tim gives a whole bunch of information, but you're just reading out a couple of his bullet points. He said, Ice gets no dialogue in this issue. Again, no agency for her, no chance to express how she feels herself, just crying in one panel for Guy to comment on and ignore. Sadly, apropos for the final issue. Then he says, you're all tired of me saying it, but Dimitri is the heart of this league. This issue is another example why. Love it. You know, Tim, I'm really glad early on in this series you pointed out to me how important Dimitri is, because I see it now. Absolutely. Dimitri is such a joy in this book. And then Tim says, delighted to see Jean's farewell in the same font from his miniseries. They used it elsewhere in the series, but it makes that last page so poignant. Wow. Great eye for detail, Tim. Very nicely done. Then we're from Sean Ross from the Marvel Secret Wars and Beyond podcast and the Never Ending Reading Pile. He says, congratulations, Shag. While I know there's many more episodes to come, finishing the series proper is a huge accomplishment. Thanks for the hundreds of hours of entertainment about a series we all love. Aw, that was so nice of you to say, Sean. Thank you. And I did check, based on your comment, and whew, so far we're up to, it looks like, about 165 hours this podcast has gone so far. I'll add the number up again at the end when we're done. But yeah, so folks, you spent 165 hours of your life listening to me. Boy, did you waste your life, people. Then we hear from Siskoid from the Firewater Podcast Network about issue 60. He says, all the tears. Yeah, it was a tearjerker for sure. Then we're from Evertom Vieira do Carmo from our Brazil embassy. He says, dude, you solved a mystery in my mind. I always wondered why a comedy series ended with such a depressing ending. And he means Justice League Europe, number 36. He goes, I imagine this was given DeMatteis putting the toys back in the box after playing with them, now knowing that they didn't write the epilogue. It also explains why it wasn't published in Brazil during the original publication in the 90s. Issue 60 is the last and then skips to Justice League Spectacular. Yeah, there you go. Mystery solved. And he says, P.S., when was that Blue Jay photo taken? I can't imagine the heroes leaving Angor destroyed by radiation with a photo as a souvenir. But I also can't imagine them stopping to take a photo while they're deactivating nuclear missiles in the early issues of Justice League. That's a great point. When was that photo taken? I have no idea, because it does look like they took time to go to like an Olin Mills, you know, photo studio for a shot. So who knows? Then we're from DC Dave. It says, I don't have much to add other than thank you. I've been here for the whole ride. I didn't want it to end, but like all good things, it must. Another great episode, another great guest. Although that host. Yeah, I agree with you. I don't, Dave. Then he says, I'll be here with you until you finish the other coverage, but thanks for bringing us all the way through one of the best runs of comics ever. Aw. Very nice of you to say, and I agree. Fantastic run of books. Then we're from Jake Muir from the South African Embassy, who says, I remember opening this issue for the first time like it was yesterday. It was such a sad day, but man, oh man, did the trio of J.M. DeMatteis, Keith Giffen, and Kevin Maguire deliver all the feels. After the nonstop action in the previous issues, this was a heartfelt ending. Then we heard from Diablo Frank from the Rolled Spine Podcasting Network. He has a Martian Manhunter blog called Idlehead of Diablo. He's got a new Terminator podcast called Terminator Now. And he wrote nearly 3,000 words. This is a manifesto that Diablo Frank put together in the style that he used to do for our Who's Who podcast. Now, I will say nearly a third of this is praising Keith Given in a very frank fashion. So definitely go out to our website and check out these comments. I mean, they're really worthwhile reading. I did cherry pick some things Frank said, but especially the Keith Given praise is really worth checking out. So going further down in there, he says, another instance of my accepting the party line uncritically regarding Martian Manhunter being in the constant Justice League member post-crisis. Jean was the quittingest member, leaving first and staying away the longest. I'm still kind of mad at myself for supporting and promoting that propaganda, especially since it's also meant that Manhunter had no true identity outside his league membership. Yeah, I mean, there's been this zeitgeist thought that Martian Manhunter is the heart of the Justice League, but he's really not, folks. I mean, he really wasn't even that important to the Justice League until Jerry McQuarrie, this is me talking, by the way, until Jerry Conway wrote the Justice League Detroit stuff. And then, yeah, Frank's right. Martian Manhunter quits a lot. So it's a myth. It's a myth that I like. I like him as the heart and soul of the team. But if you really count up stuff, he's really not. All right, then he says, I'm sure glad the final issue of the 5-year run was spent cementing the redemption arc for Maxwell Lord, so that no one would ever turn him into a one-dimensional sociopath for shock value at the hands of crappy 21st century scripters. I'm sensing some sarcasm, Frank. He says, also, for I must, it does make it clear that the relative importance to the soul of the team between Max and Jean. Ultimately, Max loses his way without Jean, and regardless of my wishes, the post-JLI stories illustrate that. Huh. So I guess I'd have to think about that. Like, what is losing Jean due to Max, and could that explain where the writers take him letter? Maybe. And then Frank says, despite having heard every episode of this podcast and having it come up last episode, I still had to go check up on when exactly Blue Jay came into the European League. I will say, though, I like his color scheme, and his page got sold so hard that I had to stop and remember, oh yeah, it's Blue Jay, though. It really was a great page, wasn't it? But yeah, for that character. And he says, besides kneading with my whole heart for Kevin Maguire to come back for the finale, I really enjoyed that this issue had no adversary or action and focused solely on the vignettes with members of the team. That's right in the pocket for JLI. My first issue was Moving Day, and this was pretty much that, but more heartfelt and less funny. Though there was funny. You know, that's a great descriptor for that issue, Frank. I hadn't thought about the fact that there was no adversary. Yeah, yeah. It's such a great ending. It says, I've always adored the cover concept for issue 60, and I'm so glad that they didn't do the 60th homage to number one instead. In fact, because of my knowledge, no one has ever swiped it. I think it's I'm warmer to it nowadays because of that. Interesting, yeah. It would be interesting to see someone do sort of a homage to issue 60. And he says, I appreciated the DeMatteis afterscript. It helped provide closure and ended a run on a sweet note. And then Frank takes me to task, all right? Speaking specifically about, I don't know what I said. I have no clue. You know, Frank is franking. But I said something probably about the comedy in Justice League and how people didn't appreciate it at the time or how great it was and it could have kept going, whatever. Either way, Frank takes me to task here. He says, Shag's full of it. General audiences lost interest in the JLA after Adam Hughes left, meaning the run overstayed its welcome by nearly 2 years. Breakdowns was exhausting. The approach was based in responding to the grim likes of Moore and Miller. The zeitgeist was chromium-colored, scowling and bloodlessly violent with speed lines and cross-hatching. It was thongs and blades. The JLI was not meant for this world or wanted in it. We were there. Don't deny it. You may have had it at the time, but you have to know that to your left and right were spikes and chains. The audience did not want JLI in 1992. In fact, they broadly hated that sort of thing, and it was the nostalgia for it all after the 90s metal had begun to rust that restored its esteem. Otherwise, we'd be listening to a Strike Back podcast about right about now. All right, Frank. God, it hurts, but you make a great point. You're right. Even if Giffen and DeMatteis had continued, even at their best, you're probably right. 1992 was not the year for that kind of comic. Everything was going Image, or worse, everything was chasing Image really badly. And so you're probably right. It probably was better that it ended because it wouldn't have kept going in the way that we would have wanted. Man, I hate it when Frank's right. All right, folks. Then we heard from Chris Pine, who is the guy who crashed the Dennis convention to steal free drinks and appetizers. Chris says, I thoroughly enjoyed this episode. This podcast run is an amazing accomplishment. Shag and Joe Casey was the perfect guest to end the main series with. Getting to hear a little more Keith Giffen appreciation from someone with firsthand knowledge was amazing. Then he says, this issue of JLA had everything I loved about the Giffen DeMatteis League, which I felt was encapsulated in that wonderful Sue and Ralph page. Getting to see them joke around with each other and then have a quiet, human moment between husband and wife really was pitch perfect. Then he says, but this issue doesn't stop with Sue and Ralph. It gives us everything we love about Jean and Beetle and Dimitri and Rex. Hell, it even gets Wally right. I seriously could have read 200 pages of just this kind of stuff. Shoot it right in my veins. And I'm also glad they didn't shoehorn in any big names or past members to the cameo this issue, focusing on this cast of characters who I felt were the heart of the series. And he says, getting time with these people at the end was more meaningful to me than having a Captain Marvel or Dr. Fate or Batman pop up for a few panels, because this book wasn't made on the backs of the more recognized DC intellectual property. It was a cranky dwarf and a shady businessman. It was an opportunistic time traveler and a hilarious inventor, a formal model turned spy and an ice princess, a hot-headed jerk and a compassionate alien who likes Oreos. Even the cover shows that off, with almost a smugness and a smirk as if to say, yeah, that's right. This is the Justice League of B-list superheroes that we made into a huge success. Want to make something of it? Oh, that was fantastic, Chris. Thank you. I got to say, a lot of insightful stuff there. Thank you. And then again, we got lots of nice comments, a lot of congratulations across social media. I'm just going to name check a bunch of people who said some nice things. Edwin Billett, Ryan Prinkley, Mark Rosella, John Coos, Ryan Blake, John Wilson, Michelle Fife, Michael Atchison, Nuno Duarte, Lauren Austin, Paul Hicks, Crazy Joe Adventures, Stop, Let's Team Up, a comic podcast, Norman Wins, and Razzla Medazzla. So thank you to all you folks for saying the nice things you said about us on social media. We appreciate it. All right, now is the part of the show where we thank everyone who share the JLI podcast on their social media timeline. We're talking Facebook, Twitter, and Blue Sky. It is a long list of names. However, these individuals, they show their support and help promote the show. So it's really important to me that we recognize these individuals. I mean, like Brian Schufo, this is the only time he's going to mention on the podcast, but you know what? He is part of our family just as much as everyone else. And I want to say thank you. So folks, this time out, we have got nearly 100 names of people who helped promote the most recent episode. Wow. Thank you, everyone. So here is everyone who helped promote the last episode by sharing on Facebook or retweeting on Twitter or whatever the hell they call it on Blue Sky. So our thanks to Al Girding, Alan Boyce, Andre TFG, Arthol Bobby, Bill, a.k.a. The Batpod, Billy Delicious, Blue Beetle and Booster Gold Facebook page, Brian Schufo, Cadmus to Crisis, Changing Shades, Chris Franklin, Chris Lewis, Chris Lydon, Chris Wales, Coffee and Comics, Copra Press Club Facebook group, Court Carpenter, Craig McD, Daniel Daly, Dave's Comic Heroes blog, David Ace Gutierrez, Days of High Adventure podcast, DC All-Stars podcast, Derek Crabb, Diablo Frank, Diego Stranges, Doug Adamson, Dr. Jennifer Schwartz-Levine, Ed Moore, Edwin Billett, Fan Films Friday podcast, Frederico Hernandez, Full Metal Moose, Geek to Me Radio, Gus Casals, Jacob Weatherford, James Enstall, Jason R. Lady, Jeff Hunter, Joe Lewis Winchester, J.P. Rocha, Julia Rowell, Justice League Revisited, Keechee Baker, Kirk Spencer, Con L, Crazy Joe Adventures, Liz Ann Oswald, Mata BG, Mark Baker Wright, Martin Gray, Martin Kogan, Matthew Cody, Max Romero, Max Traver, Michael Kramer, Michael Thomas, Mike Dynas, Mo Walker, Nuno Duarte, Outcasters, Batman and the Outsiders podcast, Patrick Link, Patrick's Tactics and Tutorials, Paul Hicks, Paul Kean, Pragmatic Golem, Prairie Justice, the Greg Saunders Vigilante podcast, Pulp Fiction Comics, Culver City, Randy Caldwell, Razzla Medazzla, Richard Field, Rob Kelly, Roger Preeb, Rolled Spine Podcast, Ryan Cheshire, S. Matthew Stolte, Scott X, Secret Wars and Beyond Podcast, Siskoid, Steve Whitebread, Stop, Let's Team Up, a comic podcast, Superman Radio Revisited Podcast, Symbol Pending, The Earth 2 Podcast, The Voice of Paul, Tim Price, Trent Lewis, Turbo Comics, Warlock Thanos Podcast, Willie Yarbrough, and Zek Cap Boots. Oh my gosh. My thanks to all of you for your support of the JLI podcast. Your feedback is such a critical part of the show, and the community of JLI fans we have built together is absolutely fantastic. If I've forgotten or missed anyone, I am terribly sorry. It is probably the fault of Joe Casey. Or maybe it's my mistake. Yeah, it's probably safer to blame me. If we did miss you, let me know, and I'll be sure to include you in the next episode. Now, folks, please keep those cards and letters coming. Or visit our website, which is fireandwaterpodcast.com/JLI. Leave your comments on the show post there. That is where most of the activity is. Then over on Facebook, you can find us as JLI Podcast or Justice League International Bwahaha Podcast. On Twitter, it's JLI Podcast. On Blue Sky, it's under FW Podcast. And the email is JLIPodcast@gmail.com. My thanks again to Joe Casey for appearing on the most recent episode of the show, and thanks to you listeners for just being awesome and being people that I love hanging out with. I mean, you guys are great. I really mean that. And really, one of my absolute favorite parts of the show is doing the feedback and, again, digitally hanging out with y'all. So thank you. Now, we're going to take a quick podcast promo break, and when we come back, we'll see if we can bring Matt Ev, JT the Exterminator, and Brett Young together in the same embassy.
I'm not a cybernetic organism, but I do have an important mission. Many of you have asked for me to create a podcast. Welcome to Terminator.
No! Celebrating the 40th anniversary of Jim Cameron's Terminator franchise, a sibling show to Dark Horse presents Aliens. Terminator Now will cover the comic book adaptations of the dystopian future sci-fi series.
So we created this for you. If you've seen my movies, I know what you might be thinking, but don't worry. This machine is a good machine, and if it ever turns bad, I will terminate the problem.
So it's me. It's flesh and blood guests. It's text-to-audio robots. Whatever it takes.
So join us. We'll always leave you feeling better.
The show will be featured in our clean language, rolled spine podcasts, four-color feed, so you can listen to stories about murder bots and the post-nuclear apocalypse with the entire family.
Do your future self a favor. Hit the subscribe button today. Come with me if you want to live.
Okay, folks, we are back from break, and yeah, it does appear the JLI teleporter has brought Matt, JT, and Brett together for us. Now, first off, Matt, thank you so much for appearing on the show again. This has been a blast. Always great to catch up with you, buddy. Why don't you tell the listeners where they can find you out on the internets?
Well, thank you so much for having me again, Shag. Always a pleasure. I used to do a comics blog. I don't do that anymore. Basically, Batman vs. Superman broke my fragile spirit.
All of us.
But if you search for Ultron is my Elvis, you will find archive pages out there. In the meantime, I'm mainly hanging around on Instagram, although it's basically all cats and yoga and food. And I'm on there as Satanic Matt, S-E-I-T-A-N-I-C Matt.
Well, that's a cheerful handle.
Satan as in the food, not the demon.
Ah, okay. Perfect. Gotcha. Well, Matt, again, I'm so glad we got a chance to get you on the show again before the end. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Well, thank you very much, Shag. Anytime.
Now, on to you, my good friend JT. It is always a blast recording with you, pal. I really appreciate you coming back and doing and even bringing this comic to my attention. Thanks so much for being here, man.
Sure.
Why don't you tell the listeners where they can find more of you?
Well, really, at one of the main places, the Epic Marvel podcast. I'm on a few different episodes co-hosting with Curtis Finley, who runs that podcast over there. It's specifically, we basically break down one of the Marvel Epic collections, one volume at a time. I am with him for the West Coast Avengers episode. Collections. We also do the Tomb of Dracula complete collections. So we've been going through that pretty much every Halloween, though we missed this past one. And then other than that, pretty much I'm outside Shag's house with an empty dog bowl waiting for another podcast invite.
Well, folks, you obviously can hear him here on the JLI podcast, or go over to Once Upon a Geek and you hear him and I talk about What If, which was a blast doing that a few months back.
Yep.
Actually, that was a year ago. I take it back. That was a year ago, man. That's crazy. Wow.
Well, after this, then another year will go by and you'll remember me.
I'll go sniffing around Buffalo looking for you. That's right.
Yep.
Well, thank you again, JT. I sincerely appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me. This is always fun, and I always love talking comics. It's a passion of mine for sure.
Absolutely. All right. Now it is my chance to say thank you to Brett for finally coming to the embassy. Your first time here. This has been an absolute blast recording together, regardless of all the cracks you made against my alma mater. Why don't you tell the listeners where they can find more of your stuff?
Well, I'm a graphic designer. My company is called Imagine 8 Design. So I can be found at imagine8design.com. I'm also on Instagram at Imagine 8 Design. I'm on Blue Sky at Imagine 8 Design. And I also have a TeePublic account where I do various designs. I did a recent one for the Batman family reunion, which Paul and Sean enjoyed a lot.
Looks great.
That's at TeePublic. If you go to TeePublic, you can find the different storefronts. My storefront is called Cool Jeep. That's just a cool-jeep. And you can see all my designs there. And that's about it.
There'll be a link in the show notes as well, folks, to that Tee Public store. So you can check that out really easy. Again, thank you so much for being here, Brett. I really appreciate it. I'm glad we finally got a chance to talk.
Yeah, this was great. I really enjoyed it. I've been a big fan of this show. You know, I was, as we talked about during the recording, I was in on the ground floor of this Justice League series. It was a great series. And this was a wonderful way of kind of bringing it all back home to me. I hadn't read the series in quite some years, but I still had all the books, and following along and reading along as your podcast was coming out was a great way to bring it all back. So you did a great job with this podcast. I know you still have some more shows coming, right?
Yep, we've got a few more. We're going to be monthly through August.
It's a great job. And again, despite what some of those guys at the Baltimore Comic Con said about you, you seem like a really nice guy. and it was a pleasure doing this. Thank you.
They were probably mostly right. At least Paul. I'll give him that. So, again, thank you, Brett. And, folks, that is going to do it. Now, come back next episode when we cover the final JLI role-playing game module from the Mayfair Games entitled Come On Down. And we'll have another guest host to help me cover the module. Who will it be? Come on, people. You know how this works. You're just going to have to wait and find out next episode. Or if you've been paying attention to the past role-playing episodes, you probably have a pretty solid guess who my guest is. Anyway, thanks for listening, everyone. Until next time, I'm Shag.
And I'm Matt.
I'm JT.
And I'm Brett.
And you've been listening to the JLI Podcast.
Want to make something of it?